It's time for Mech Break Weekly. Our annual silly season has begun. August is here, and there's not much to talk about. Fortunately, I've got Jason Snell, Andy Inako, and Alex Lindsay, who are going to find so many things to talk about, like the Congressional Subcommittee that wants to know why Apple doesn't like Web3, or the new iPad OLED that may or may not appear in October, or the French, they're mad again. Zut alors! Mech Break Weekly is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mech Break Weekly, episode 880, recorded Tuesday, August 1st, 2023. The unisex Crocs of a young person. Mech Break Weekly is brought to you by ZocDoc, the free app where you can find and book appointments online with thousands of top-rated patient review physicians and specialists. Filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat almost any condition. Go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak and download the ZocDoc app for free. And by ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, you know it's hard to attract top talent. Team up with a hiring partner who understands how tough it is and knows what you need. ZipRecruiter. Go to our exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. Or in the month of August, as we call it, the latest snooze from Apple. Jason Snell is here from SixColors.com. You still have to file at Six Colors.
I mean, do I? I run my own website, right? Like,
somebody pressuring you.
I mean, I feel some pressure in terms of I have members and I have sponsors and stuff to post content on the site. I do, for sure. But, and it's hard this time of year.
Well,
it's
I'm just looking at the top story this fine Tuesday. 57 app icons and nothing good on. I think that's a TV OS
announcement.
Think piece.
A lot of member, we got a lot of member stories up there right now. I got to do some general public stuff. But yeah, there's stuff.
Here's a good one. Summer is a two-computer season on my desk.
Right, because betas break software, and so you have to have a second computer that doesn't have broken software
got
on it. You know.
Oh, and a good article from Anze Tomic on switching to Mac.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun, you know, again, you make do with what you can. So, yeah, Anze Tomic did a piece about switching after decades using Windows. He bought his first Mac,
nice.
Like, this year.
I thought that was...
Again, there, you know, you can make that like, oh, is it like PR for Apple or whatever? No, I actually think he brought, because he's a professional computer journalist in Slovenia, he had some real insights about what Apple does well and doesn't do well, and what Microsoft Windows does well and doesn't do well. And I, when he mentioned he was doing this, I said, you write me something. And I don't think he'd ever written anything professionally in English before. So it was fun. And it's a fun little project. And he, you know, he made some really great points about how different the Mac is in some ways, and especially how trackpad focused the Mac interface is many ways.
I know that, boy. Yeah. And I see you have Maltz working for you with a show called This Week
jokes.
In Apple.
He's making jokes, you know. He's recapping.
That was a rejected name for this show, by the way.
Sure. Well, it was laying right there, and I wanted him to recap the news and make some jokes.
Maltz is great.
What Maltz does.
Do people know who Maltz is, really?
I mean, it's out there.
Is it out there? All right. Well, we don't bring it up.
Do you like? Let me put it this way. Do you like the Macalope on Macworld? Formerly have seen it. Been on Macworld for about a decade. If you do, I think you'll also like the work of John Maltz.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Surprisingly similar sense of humor.
Yeah.
That's Alex Lindsay chortling in the background. He's with OfficeHours.Global. Always has the best picture of us all. He's the fairest of them all. Hi, Alex.
Hello, hello.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
You are, we should have a colophon every week for Alex's setup so that people can duplicate it. And that is, speaking of chortling, the king of chortling, Mr. Andy Inako from WGBH in Boston.
You know, I do like these low key news times, because that's when I go to Six Colors for their annual roundup of five different ways to zest up your summer salads. I would never have thought about pairing watermelon with a wild pepper, but
it's incredible. Lemon zest is a
very, very small amounts, but yeah. you don't know what's adding the magic, but the magic is there. She's absolutely right.
I actually would read that article. Okay. What is, by the way, the camera of the day, Alex Lindsay, and the microphone?
The camera of the day is a, I'm using a Sony FX30 with their G-series 35 millimeter. So I am looking at getting a, I'm looking at the 60, I'm going to test the 6400 soon, which is a much less expensive camera, but should, I think it's going to look the same. Like it's this, it's an APS, you know, it's a Super 35 sensor. I'm trying to find more affordable ways to do what I'm doing. But
why?
But
I mean, right, you already own it. You might as well just turn it on. It doesn't cost you anything to use it, does it?
Well, like, for instance, I'm going to go down to Seagraph next week, and I want to cover it. So now I'm going to take my rig apart and put it there. So what I want to do is have one that stays here that is that looks this looks like this. I think it looks great. The big reason that I moved to the Sony's was this, of course, you know, just the focus.
Instant.
Just being able to
and what lens are you using on that FX30 there?
I have a G series, which is a super painful weight. It costs as much as the camera.
I know.
Or almost more expensive. The camera. So, so I've got a G series 35 millimeter 1.4.
Nice.
I just got a 14 millimeter 1.4 for Seagraph. No, so that I can.
Because your nose isn't big enough? What? So you can.
The 35 is too close. And so so you wander around. The problem is weird problems is that you're at a booth, you know, you have a booth here. And you want to interview someone, and this is the aisle. And when you have a 35 millimeter,
there's no room.
And you're standing here, you got to be standing back here to get the booth.
Yeah.
With a 14 millimeter, I can get to the inside of that. You know, and so getting the
do people get weird though? Because I know sometimes they shoot films with a very wide angle cameras, and there it's you don't know it when you're watching the film, but the actor is camera's right in his face or her face.
Yeah, it can be a little odd. I mean, this one looks pretty good. I mean, it's a really high quality glass. Again, very expensive lens.
Very nice.
But the main thing is that the big problem is that we can get closer because no matter what you do, no matter how hard you work, people will walk through your camera.
Yep.
And you're like I was at NAB and people are like, oh, I have to push through this, even though there's plenty of room behind them. I, as the person walking, has to walk through this shot.
I make it a virtue out of a necessity. It's like, oh, this is fun because you're in a crowded. I know you want a good shot.
We usually have people standing on either side of the interview that literally just tell people to go that way. Yeah. Like we're not even, you know, we just put our arms out.
I like the cinema verite of people, you know, walking by while you're talking to someone. I think that's fun.
I do not like that part.
All right. And the microphone, I think we've already established that.
No, this is a Stellar X2. It's not a
particularly
expensive.
Oh, it is a new microphone. Oh.
This has been around. I've had it for a couple of years. This is a, I had a Neumann. I have a Neumann 102.
Yeah, I thought you were in a Neumann. This looks just like
it was a Neumann 102. This one is one third the cost. So this is a this Stellar X2 is
$200.
$200. We tested it head to head, and folks on office hours said that they liked it better. So I have that, and then I have this. This is a OC White Ultima arm, which is very nice. You can swing things around and put things in. That costs more than the mic. Anyway, but you know, when you're on air for, you know, as you know,
somebody
you're on
asked
air
me
for a long time,
what was the name of those arms Alex likes? And I said, you don't want it.
It's good. The reality is the $100 one that Elgato makes, the low P, the LP, it's 90% as good as the one that I have. Like, there is a flexibility in this arm to do this that I never use, but I can do that in a way that would be hard to do on the. On the Elgato arm, but when we send things out, we send the Elgato arm out. It's a good.
Yeah, you're not going to send really a $300 mic arm.
Yep.
Super.
I use the Elgato arm, and it's good, and it's nice to have a low profile.
It's not that one. That's
arm.
It's the LP from Elgato. There's one. It's a low profile because you don't want that big thing hanging.
You're right.
It's between me and my monitors.
How ugly
I have
that?
Monitors all the way. Well, I have monitors going all around me, so. If it hangs over, I don't know where to put it where I don't have to look around it. So
there really is nothing going on if we're talking about our microphone setup. Let's just keep going.
I'm enjoying
this. Sure, SM7B.
This week
you know, I got the
SM7B is very nice. It's a little brighter than Alex's. It's not so rich.
Yeah.
The SM7B is great. The real secret is the Mix Pre. Mix Pre with noise assist. Like I have fans, all kinds of. Oftentimes I have fans going on all around me, and you don't hear any of it because of the.
It's true. I can't hear anything.
The most attached to.
Yeah. Nice.
It's it's hard to like what be it's hard to like turn off the fans and turn off the air conditioners in your studio when you realize that like 5 years ago, like, okay, that's going to cause such a problem for the person editing this that I'm not going to do that. When you realize that, but he has probably like a switch that says remove the air conditioning noise.
Like, you definitely can.
It's a lovely gesture, but maybe I could like not be sweating while I'm doing
because this. I'm doing a live show. I'm more sensitive to it. You know, like when I'm doing office hours or here when we're live, but when we're doing office hours, it's just done. Like it goes up to YouTube. There's no post. Like it's just, it's the way we streamed it. So that's when you get sensitive to having real time noise reduction. But you're right. The noise reduction that's out there, whether it's through Isotope or Zenaptic Unveil, those are the two that, like, if Isotope will do 90% of them. And when Isotope can't do it, you pull out Zenaptic Unveil and you're like, I will remove, like, especially if you have reverb, Zenaptic Unveil is like this. It magically takes the reverb out in a way that, I've never seen anything else do.
Nice. Is this the OC White Pro Boom Ultima Gen 2 Ultra Low Profile Adjustable Mic Boom without mount?
Yeah, that's it.
It's only 320.
Really nice.
Andy and I are using Fisher-Price microphones. It's my first microphone from Sony.
Given how hot that movie is, I'm kind of regretting spray painting the pink of this Barbie mic that I got at the yard sale 3 years ago. That would have been very, very on point right now.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the Heil is
it's actually more expensive than the Stella. Stellar that you're using.
Stellar. Yeah. It is. And it has much better off-axis rejection. Like in this.
Well, because it's
dynamic.
Yours is a condenser. So.
You don't understand. Like I have a tent around me I'm looking into because otherwise this mic will not work. Like it's all hard surfaces and it is like this is, I mean, for those watching, this is the, that's what I'm looking at.
So when you look at me, it's all over.
I look totally.
Doesn't it get sweaty in there?
No, I have an air conditioner right on the far corner.
This is what they used to do to me and with Dev Null. Holy cow.
So I have all my monitors switcher and my telestrator is right on this little arm that swings out. And so
it's funny because you're staring into that. I'm staring into the soulless eyes of John Slonina. So we have, but his eyes do not reflect sound. So they don't reflect light. Yeah, they're basically deep, dark pools of anger and aggression.
The most hysterically funny thing about like the way that streaming is done is when you realize exactly how much money and effort goes into making it look as though I just put up a webcam in my regular office.
Yeah. Right.
Well, the funny thing is I do a presentation that I have to do fairly often, and it takes up five computers. I have four Mac Minis and one of them is a Telestrator, the other one is a presentation machine. So it just runs Keynote, another one runs the applications that I want to show you if I'm showing a web page or whatever, and the other one Zoom, and then I have my work computer. It takes me like a half an hour to get ready for the presentation. Like I have to get everything wired and routed and ready to go. But it's it looks like nothing's happening until there was one person that I did it for. And someone was like, how do you do that on one computer? I'm like, four computers. How you do it on one computer.
Yeah. So. You don't know how many computers. Yeah. I do notice a new thermos bottle behind you. Is that Fizzile material? Or are you working on superconductor creation?
No, this is one of those Hydra sparks.
Oh, okay.
So it's visionable,
it looks like it's fissile. It does really look like you've got something sub 200 degrees in there.
I do.
No, I Alex, do. That was the deuterium. No!
The demon core lives.
You know, I oftentimes in the office I do have a Dewar for nitrogen.
Oh yeah, that's fun. Yeah, that's always fun. Yeah.
So I have got like a 2 liter. You can go up to Santa Rosa or not, get liquid nitrogen. They'll just pour the liquid nitrogen in there for you, and then it's the best way to make ice cream.
I will tell you. Besides, I mean, there are several clues. This is a slow news month. August is really slow.
We're talking about
besides
Alex's
the fact that we're talking about Alex's setup. The top story is Amsterdam builds massive bike garage resembling an Apple store. So that's the closest I could come to an Apple store.
That is the most Amsterdam thing to do.
Isn't that great, though? I wish we had this.
It's so Amsterdam is so much fun. You get there, it's so flat that you feel like you every time I go,
yeah.
I usually get there every year or two, and for IBC, it's the Rye. And the Rye is like a 45 or 50, maybe an hour walk out of downtown, and I do it all the time. Like, I'll just walk to the Rye from the center area. But because of that also, there's just everybody's got bikes.
Like, I think somebody told me there's two or three bicycles per capita. Yeah,
in
Amsterdam. Yeah,
I've ridden the bike in Amsterdam.
But. Oh man, there's like a highway.
Yeah, that's great.
There's like these bicycle highways. It's like almost scary because there's so many people. Yeah, this is free for the first 24 hours. Can you believe that? And the pictures, that's by awesome. The way, there is another Mac tie-in there, or by Sebastian DeWitt, of course, of Halide fame. So they're particularly good images. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us for this week. No, we have other stories. The Teamsters have reached a contract, so your next MacBook may still come from UPS. That deal, there was a strike pending, looming, but that's not going to happen.
I will say that Apple's store delivery is the best. Like, I get a lot of stuff delivered. You get Amazon.
You get it couriered over, though, right? It's not...
It gets to me faster than I could go.
Some Uber Eats guy in a bicycle drop it off?
No, it's someone. I don't know. Someone they drop it off in a nice little. I just got one.
A Camry,
like a nice little bag, like a little white bag, and it's and they ring in and they're very cheery and they're like, hey, I just need you to sign this and we're good and
that's awesome.
It is faster. It is faster to get it than for me to drive there. It's
I should amazing. Do so. I guess they. Of course, you're near Corte Madera.
Yours would come from Santa
Rosa, and that's a little farther.
But it should be fast. But it'd still be fast. I mean,
I should try that.
It's not worth.
What could I buy?
I got another Mac Mini.
Did you?
That's what, nice. Yeah. So
there's nothing new to buy yet. Although we are only about a month and a half away from a new iPhone. Lots of rumors about the iPhone 15. Any of them credible, Jason? Anything that we should be paying?
Yeah,
attention
I mean,
to?
Mark Gurman at Bloomberg did his annual like roundup where he sweeps up all his reporting for the last year about the new iPhone, last year plus. Sometimes it's more than a year out, and along with supply chain sources and all of that. And we're getting a better idea now. Obviously, it's going to have last year's Pro processor on it, on the low end. There will be a new 3-nanometer processor on the high end. Lots of talk about camera upgrades across the board. My guess is that they may do something with that 48 megapixel sensor in the lower end phones this year, although probably still only have a couple of lenses on it. And there's this unclear kind of hovering out there thought that there's a major upgrade happening somewhere in the Pro line in terms of the camera. There have been lots of rumors about periscope lens style thing, although nobody seems to have nailed it down. And it's getting all of us who track this, I think, to start wondering if it's not quite a periscope lens, right? Like it's a, I don't know, it's Apple, right? They did something a little different. They're going to give it a brand name and they're going to be like, oh, no. It's not like Samsung at all. It's slightly different and has a different brand name. But that would be, the thing that I keep thinking might happen is that the Pro Max might kind of graduate to be like an iPhone Ultra. And the reason you do that is if its camera, you know, if it was so differentiated from the regular Pro that it didn't make sense to sell it as just a big version of the Pro. And if that's true, that would be very interesting. If it was like by far the best iPhone camera ever made, that would be an interesting selling point. Might be worth a rename and might at that point also be worth a price hike probably because we live in that world too.
What does a periscope camera do? What makes it special?
So the thin, I mean, I'm sure Alex could talk about this too, but the idea is your phone is thin, right? And the fact is your optics just light into cameras get better when you have a longer lens, right? If you think about a camera with a long lens, you have the ability to zoom. There's just a lot of the optics become simpler if you have more room to work
telephoto
with.
Telephoto is...
And that's, right. That's why we have a camera bump, right? Is that they need more room in there. Well, if you put in a mirror and so you can use the depth, you know, the length, I guess, of your phone instead of the thickness of your phone, you've got way more room to play with in there. Other than that, now you're cannibalizing, like you're eating battery and other things inside the phone. But it's probably worth the trade if you want a really great camera experience. So that may be what they're doing. And that's lots of other phone makers have done the same thing because it's just physics, right? I mean, you can't argue with how light works.
Yeah, this is a Samsung Galaxy S23 Ultra. that has a periscope lens, which gives it 200 millimeter optical, I think. Is it optical? Maybe not, but it gives it a very, very long lens in a very thin package. And the telephoto, I mean, the New York Times, I'm looking for some pictures. The New York Times review says the Samsung S23 Ultra has a great camera you don't need. But I'll find you some, I have some pictures I took. I'll show you an example. Can you go off my, thank you. I'm going to show you an example that I have some. Go ahead, Andy,
The Pixel 6 and 7 also have, like, most Android cameras on the top end have, like, a periscope camera.
That's how they compete with Apple, right?
It's always a competition across the board to make the best pictures. And I am just shocked at what, like, just this model, my model has just a 4X zoom. The new models have, like, have an actual 10X optical zoom. And then when you add, like, algorithmic trickery on top of that, the ability to say, there have been times where, like, I've been at the beach and I've seen, like a dot or two dots sort of like on the horizon, and I want to get a closer look at it, and I will actually take out my phone now and actually see that it's actually like a fireboat chasing a sailboat that's kind of in trouble. We're really changing from the times when the phone used to be like the cardinal example of do not use the digital. I know that it says the digital zoom. Do not use the digital zoom under any circumstances.
And I will say that, you know, it's the phone is still the thing that everyone's competing. I mean, we can put a lot of other features into it, but the number one
cameras
thing people are doing with their phone is taking pictures.
That's why there are AI chips in cameras and phones now. Because
I took a night picture of the Rafale the other day, and I was just like, I couldn't believe I took that from a phone. You know, it was just like, what is going? You know, it's just really, really amazing.
Did you use the standard camera app, or did you use?
Yeah, I just opened it up and just took a picture. I was like, I want to do a little post about. I watched this movie, and I was like, I'm doing a little post about it, and I
really good. And it's not just about like telephoto sort of effects. It's also about the ability to, like, when I'm using like a modern phone, I really am using it like a regular camera, where I'm thinking, gee, I really wish that the subject in the foreground was larger compared with like the background. So, I have an actual like real telephoto lens in here. If I just back up, instead of standing a foot away, if I stand 4 or 5 feet away and then engage the telephoto, just like when I'm with my $1,000 camera with the $2,000 lens, I will have the exact same optical effect because, like Jason said, like optical physics of light is always the physics of light, whether it's on a phone or whether it's on like a $10,000 camera.
I think you're right. 10X was the on the Samsung is the optical max. But then I'll give you an example. This was when I first got it. We went out to the beach to test it out. This is the widest angle. Keep your eye on those people in the little dots in the distance, because I'm zooming in on them. by the time I don't know if he was taking a picture of me or not, but by the time I zoomed in all the way, now you see it does get a little soft. That's probably the 200X. I think he sees me taking a picture of him, but we are quite a ways away. And
you combine that with, you think about that 48 megapixel sensor that the Apple's not really, I mean, by default, it's basically just being binned into a 12 megapixel image. So there's, you know, if they can get a longer optical zoom and then also have that very sensitive sensor, or maybe even an even better sensor than that, I don't know. Everything's really hazy about this one, but
which is unusual. According to Gurman, Apple, towards the end of July, Foxconn does, I think we talked about this last week, they do like 100,000 just to see if they can produce it in quantity. And they don't really step into full production until later this month in August. Here's Mark's Power On newsletter you were talking about from this week. The iPhone 15 will have thinner bezels in step toward Apple's dream.
Yeah, there's a new process. It's funny when you talk about the bezels, because like I believe bezels actually do matter, but nobody notices them. And then you look back at your previous phones and you think, oh no, that
big
bezel is huge.
Yeah.
So going from whatever it is, going from 2.2 millimeters to 1.7 millimeters, that's a very small amount, and yet percentage wise, it's actually substantial, and you probably will notice. And that's always one of their goals. So they've gone through a whole process there. That seems to have survived the production process. There were some stories about like how that was a technical difficulty. He also says that that rumor about them replacing all the buttons with fake buttons, basically, that vibrate when you press on them, but they don't actually move. And they basically didn't work and they pulled them out. But it does sound like the ring, the mute switch, the ring silence switch is getting replaced with an action button.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Which basically means so you can program it to do something
but
else.
But you could program it to silence, I guess.
If you were like, you can, but if you're like me and you always leave your phone muted, I can use that button for something better.
It's just like the watch. I've never used the action feature on the Ultra, the action button on the Ultra, for anything but a stopwatch, and I very rarely use it. But you could attach it to a shortcut, even. You could have it do something fairly sophisticated.
It's unclear, because that's a software choice. I hope so. I hope you could do shortcuts, because then you could do anything.
There was a rumor there would be also a shortcut widget, like an action button widget, right? Or no? Yeah. Maybe I'm confusing the two.
I don't know.
They're going to make these screens, according to Gurman, with LiPo technology. So it's thinner because they take the fat out. No, it stands for low injection pressure over molding, which would give it a much thinner bezel, 1.5 millimeters. The standard iPhone 15 will have a dynamic island instead of a notch. But the Pro and the Pro Max will be made with LiPo. Does that mean it's going to still have a notch? It's not... The way he words this is unclear.
I think so, but you can see what's happening here, which is it's this typical Apple iteration, except now what they're doing is they're iterating, and then the next year they push it all down into the other phone. So very rapidly, this year's phone will be, this year's cheaper phone will be last year's Pro phone in a lot of ways.
Right.
And they just keep on doing that cycle where there's always something new coming at the high end.
I love the dynamic island on the Pro Max right now. I'd be sorry to lose that to a notch.
Exactly. I think that's a classic example of Apple taking a disadvantage and turning it into an advantage. I think it's a really wonderful innovation.
Yeah.
There's always rumors that they want to do everything under display so that there will be no notch, there'll be no pill, there'll be nothing. There'll be a camera underneath the display that's not affected by the display above it. There was a story a couple of weeks ago about how Apple has reached some display analyst's blog, saying that Apple has been reaching out to display manufacturers saying that here's what we want our display to be by 2017, and that they're asking for true edge-to-edge display, like without the cheat that a lot of Android phones use, which is it's technically a curved display, but they hide the curve so that you don't actually see it. They say, no, we want build us a display technology so that the entire front surface will be an active display. And with Apple, there's so much really brilliant engineering that is never visible. And one of them is just simply edge rejection. With other manufacturers, like if Samsung were doing something like this, you would wonder, oh my God, how many updates are people going to have to go through before it's impossible to hold the phone without actioning something on the screen, because you've got your fingers are going to wrap around somewhere. Apple, I'm certain, is putting lots and lots of work into figuring out just technology to figure out what is an actual touch, which is what is simply incidental via just holding the thing. So,
yeah, I think because we are tech nerds and we're also consumers of these products, the one of the things that doesn't get enough press that I think, Leo, you mentioned that LiPo technology, right? But it's like there's so much high-end hardware engineering going on here or even the button thing where you can't just make it. You have to make it and then have the factory make it and have them not break. And if they break, you got to pull them out because that's not good enough, because Apple's going to make millions of these. This is the iPhone, right? It can't fail, one, because it's more than half of Apple's business. And two, they make it in such extreme volumes that the stakes are so high, and that this is serious, like hardware, nitty gritty engineering. And, I admire any company, not just Apple, but any company that says, you know what, 2 millimeters bezel, it's pretty good. Not good enough, right? We're going to do a whole new process. And then they spend years doing this. And now we're at the moment where it must be quite an accomplishment for the people who work on this stuff to get to the moment where it actually rolls out on the factory and it works and they function. And you're like, oh, we can ramp it up now and we can make a million of these things. And like, it's really amazing. Some of the remarkable technology that has to go into these things for them to do what they do.
And it's really become a big boys game. You know, like phones are not something that there's like Samsung and Apple and maybe Google and a couple others there, but there's not that many people that can play this game anymore. You know, like it's just the refinement and the level of which they're playing is, you know, truly everybody else is playing high school ball, and there's a handful that are playing pro ball, and it's just really hard to compete because the costs of building this up at scale are so difficult. And you pick up a lot of these other phones, and you can, as an Apple user, you feel it really fast, you know, that of the drop off, you know. And but, you know, Samsung does great ones, and Pixel, you know, the it's not just Apple, but the point is that it was this huge market, and now there's a group of cell phone makers that are making these really high end. Everyone else kind of fell away.
I read a story the other week, and I wish I could remember what it was, but it was somebody talking about how a lot of the people in the press were quibbling about some companies. It was like a fine, or it was a purchase, or it was a write down. And the point of the article was, none of us have really grappled a lot with the scale of big tech companies and just how huge they are, and just how things that to us seem like, oh, they might buy this company and they might spend $1 billion on it. And yet in for a business the size of Apple's, it's essentially irrelevant because they're so huge. And I think that goes to your point, Alex, that this is not a game that can be played unless you have the ability to essentially move markets and build factories by ordering. Because like anytime Apple orders a part for an iPhone, it is millions and millions and millions of units. They can't not have all of those units because that's how many they ship in volume. And like, so that's where the game is being played now. And it's troubling in the sense that, you know, you can't be in the game unless you are a gigantic company.
And the ripples are incredible. I was talking to a manufacturer and complaining about the fact that they had announced something that they hadn't shipped for 6 months. Like they hadn't shipped it. And they said, we share one component with the iPhone. Like that we didn't know that we were sharing with the iPhone until Apple bought all of them. You know, and now we have to redesign the entire architecture of the piece of hardware because you can't get that. You know, like Apple buys them years in advance, all the capacity years in advance to supply the iPhone, and there's not, you know, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah. So, but the good news is that not everybody is going to appreciate that 2 millimeter bezel. And not a lot of people are not willing to pay extra money for that 2 millimeter bezel. So there's a lot of room for people for companies that want to just manufacture commodity phones. Like people who buy new phones, not because they're enticed by, hey, the new Periscope camera. Oh my goodness. Look at this 4-letter acronym for this new manufacturing technique, which is very, very significant to people who are very, very into that stuff. But people who drop their phone in the toilet or they broke their screen one time too many and they're back in the Verizon store with like, what can I get without having on a 2-year plan for free? And those phones are amazing. They're awesome. I keep reflecting back on the fact that smartphones are now so, the manufacturing and design process and the procurement process for each component is now so on lock that people who are economically disadvantaged in this country, they can get a free smartphone that is certainly not an iPhone 15 or 14, but it's an iPhone 7, 8, or 9, and that is pretty damn good.
So one of the advantages Apple has, apparently, is that they can use the watch as a test lab. LiPo was first tried on the Apple Watch. And now they're, according to Gurman, going to put titanium. We're looking at, they've always wanted to have titanium edges on the outside of the iPhone. And they've been doing that in the watches. And that, according to Gurman, was a test for bringing titanium to the higher volume device. So they're going to replace these shiny fingerprint prone stainless steel edges.
Heavy. With heavy stainless steel.
Heavy.
Too. Titanium
right.
is so much lighter. And
right.
Anybody who's a longtime Apple person will remember back when Apple didn't have a team of metallurgists on staff and it painted, put white paint on titanium and the titanium PowerBook. Well, they don't do that stuff anymore. Yeah. Titanium is anodizable, just like aluminum is, so they can impart
colors.
A color onto it as part of the anodization process.
Nice.
And I mean, I've got a titanium Apple Watch. It is so light. It is such a light material. And I think the worst thing about the Pro phones the last few years, well, not colorful, right, is part of it. And that is a Apple philosophy thing. But also part of it is they're just so heavy. They're really heavy. And the stainless steel does not help. So going to titanium, they can call it, you know, I'm sure they'll invent some magical, like, let me tell you about the alloy that we built. It's off the periodic table. It's so great. But in the end, that benefits the user because you made a lighter phone, right? Like that's a win.
But that's it's an interesting comparison, though. I still think that there's a difference between the expectations of people who are spending $500, $600, $700 on a watch and people who are spending $1,000, $1,100, $1,200 on a phone. Like, do people, and I'm asking this as a question, I'm not saying that, saying this as a statement, that are there parts of the market that says, I don't want, if this is a light, if you, congratulations, you just made this $800 watch a lot lighter. I didn't mind the weight of the original watch, and now it feels chintzy. It doesn't feel like I've got this big, meaty chunk of metal on my, packed with gears and technology on my wrist. It's not a statement anymore. It's a rational solution to a pressing engineering problem that affects real people. And that's not what I want as a watch consumer. I want a big chunk of unobtainium. I want this case be made of finger bones from one of the top three apostles out of Requillery. That's what I want in this watch.
I just find it amazing that Apple has somehow gotten us comfortably to talk about $350 watches as cheap. You know, like you know, that or inexpensive.
Well, I mean, paid $700 for mine, so.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, which is really stupid because you shouldn't spend so much money on something you upgrade every year, right? Well, maybe
I have decided. I bought the Ultra, and I decided I'm going to skip a couple years now.
Yeah.
I'm probably not going to buy this one every year.
Yeah, but wait until they announce what same thing.
Yeah, wait until they announce what they're going to put in it, though. You know, you never know. They might have that key feature that you've been waiting for.
I know. I bought the Sport one over and over, the lowest cost.
Me too.
Watch.
Me too.
Every year. I was just like, I'm just going to buy the cheap one because I don't want to commit because I know that they're going to keep on making it better. Over the last couple of years, I felt like the only real innovation I had seen that I really cared about was in the Ultra. And I actually do use the Backtrack, which helped me a couple weeks ago.
The what? The Backtrack? Oh, the like breadcrumbs? It leaves breadcrumbs?
Waypoints. Yeah.
You get lost a lot, don't you? You lose your car. You lose yourself. Is there something going on? Maybe you should get
Alex is living 15 minutes in the future, man. He can't be distracted by stuff like that.
Why did you get lost?
I was taking a hike and it was a lot of little paths. I was like, it was a lot of little paths and places that I hadn't been.
Yeah. That's how Backtrack works. It actually senses that you're out in the wilderness. There's no Wi-Fi around.
Oh, it doesn't do it unless you're automatically.
Yeah, that's right. It's tracking you when you don't have anything around you.
Is that the secret behind all those Apple Watch ads about like people being rusty because of their watch? It's not that it's a better survival tool. It's just that people who buy Apple Watches are more absent-minded.
Exactly.
We need them to wander off.
I was just wandering around. Yeah. I feel like every other year, maybe every 2 years is probably going to be my cadence.
But then it depends.
I say that. I know. I say that.
The good thing is at least you can keep the bands.
Yeah.
You don't have to buy new bands.
I will say it's rugged. I love the Ultra. Now since it was released.
I know. No dings. No cracks.
I have to admit, I don't see any dings on it after not taking care of it.
I bang it around.
So I feel like I could probably, hand it in for
it's
something.
Giant.
Something else.
It's ginormous.
That's what I liked about it. I'm getting old. I needed a watch that had a bigger face.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm resisting the bifocals. This is still, I'm like, I need to just be a little bigger. My arm just be a little longer, and then I can keep using this watch.
Well, just keep wearing this watch. Your arms will get longer. There were engineering problems, though. Apple has canceled Bongo. So if you were looking forward to Bongo, this is the code name.
Those are those buttons, right?
The Bongo buttons, yeah. I get it, like a Bongo drum. Apple had planned another major feature, Mark Gurman writes in his Power On newsletter on Bloomberg, only $400 a year. Apple had planned another major feature. I spend the money so you don't have to. Apple had planned another major feature for this year's Pro models, touch-sensitive buttons with haptic feedback for the volume controls, the mute ring switch, and the power button. Like trackpads on the Mac, the buttons would not actually move, allowing new software tricks and reducing the number of breakable components on the device. The enhancement, codenamed Bongo, was canceled.
Oh. I mean, the one thing I have to say is a watch app called Bongo that was actually turned your watch into a bongo drum. Kind of fun.
That would be so cool. We need Drum Circle. Somebody should do an app called Drum Circle.
Apple Watch Drum Circle, but with
I'll say one thing that would certainly improve Apple's revenue per consumer.
In the end, the company decided to keep standard buttons for volume and power, but turn, this is what you were talking about, turn the mute ring switch to the into a so-called action button like on the Apple Watch. Okay. What else should we, what else can we say based on this Power On newsletter? There's code in iOS 17 that hints at options for the action button. You'll be able to choose, according to Steve Moser at Mac Rumors, from several possibilities. Mute, of course, will still stay there for people like a physical mute button. A focus mode, like do not disturb. That's better than mute, right? Because I could say, you know, I could have a little more control over what it is. Launching the camera, turning on the flashlight. If you use a flashlight a lot, I use it a surprisingly lot. I wonder if flashlight sales have declined just as point-and-shoot camera sales have declined.
Oh, you mean, yeah.
Because who needs a flashlight, right?
I use my phone flashlight all the time. At least once a day.
You might want that action button to be a flashlight.
Because when I'm lost, I forget things. And I turn on the
flashlight by accident. People are always pointing to my breast pocket saying, your flashlight's on. It's the new, your zipper's down. Your flashlight's on.
I have found that the flashlight also requires very little power. I've accidentally
left
my
flashlight
on for a very long time.
Oh, that's a relief.
Yeah, a lot less than the screen, yeah.
Oh, that's a real relief. I always worry that I'm killing my battery. Or opening features for accessibility or translating text. I wish it would have a shortcut, like you could do a shortcut.
Yeah, we'll see.
He says... Go ahead.
I just hope that Apple doesn't ruin this by saying, oh, well, you can do these three things as opposed to, hey, or you can just simply create your own shortcut and attach it to this button.
All of us who have Samsung phones are used to that. Remember the Bixby button? There was a whole physical button that all I could do was launch Bixby.
Yeah.
They later added capabilities.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. I still don't use Bixby. One other thing I should mention, of course, the iPhone... Nothings will get the processor that's currently in the Macs, or the Pros rather, and the Pros will get a 3-nanometer A17. So that's a big deal because that might be a big jump in performance. Not that I've ever felt like my iPhone's slow, but...
Or battery life, you know, energy efficiency is the possibility
there. That's also
there,
a benefit.
Especially if they have a periscope camera in some of them that carves out some battery space, right? You would potentially benefit from that. It sounds like the chips are going up. The Apple Watch is going to get a substantial chip update for the first time in like 4 years.
That's because they need Alex to buy a new one.
Yeah, that processor. So yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of kind of like chip updates. But yeah, Mark Gurman is running into the same thing all of us who write about computers run into, which is how do you describe the benefit of the new 3-nanometer chip that's going to be in the iPhone Pro? And I think he literally says, so it'll be snappier, which is the sound of giving up, right? That is like, I don't know, faster, whatever. Because they're all so fast now, and it's like, yeah, it'll be faster. It's got the snappy. Great. Snappier. Excellent.
Independent lab tests confirm that 3 is, in fact, a lower number than 5.
I'm going to actually say that that's good writing. He found exactly the right adjective. Because faster isn't the right adjective. Snappier. That's
yeah,
very...
but is it going to be... I mean, is it, though? Is it really? Are you going to pick up a brand new Pro iPhone and be like, oh, it's so snappy compared to the one last year, which is slightly less snappy than this? It's like, I mean, but it will be. Because these days all the basic tasks are so fast that the human eye can't even notice it. It's going to be like enabling new features and lots of background computations that would never have been possible before. And like, there's a lot there, but I just thought it was kind of funny because at some point your editor says, you got to say why this is relevant, right? You can't just say it's a new chip. You got to say why. And he's like, okay, let's just say it's snappier. All right. Okay.
It's snappier. That's a good word.
But it is on the 3-nanometer process. So yeah, there could be a lot of interesting quirks about that, including better, power consumption issues and things like that.
And as you said, the Apple Watch goes from the S6, which has been on forever, to an F9. It jumps way ahead, maybe, according to Gurman. Again, I think that's just for you, Alex. I don't know what you do with the watch. You need a snappier watch.
I rarely feel like I need. That's why I feel like I can probably get this one. I mean, it would really have to be incredible in September for me to update because I've skipped a couple of years with the watch and didn't really, mostly the most used app on my watch is either my my action button, which turns my lights on in the studio.
Really? That's what you use your action button for?
It's one of the things.
That's cool.
So when I walk into when I'm walking towards my studio in the morning, I hit my watch, and it's fun because you're walking towards it and all the lights come on as I'm walking into my studio.
I've been trying to think of what I should do with my action button. I like that.
I needed to find it. I needed to find a use for it, and it's convenient. Yeah. It's always on. So
I like that.
Yeah, but then I have another action somewhere else that turns them all off.
So your action button is tied to a shortcut. It must be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I know that if I say I'm going to do it right now, it'll
don't
break.
Do it. Don't do it. But don't do it, man. Don't do it. Don't do it. The sound blankets will collapse in a heap.
So
you'll just be a puddle of cotton on the floor.
On my phone is usually, or on my computer, I have lights out. You know, so if I hit that, it all turns them off.
Oh, look.
But then if I hit my watch, it should.
I like that.
If I hit my watch, it'll hopefully.
There you go. It just takes a little while to come back on. Yeah.
It takes a second for the Eve to do the thing, and then
warm up. Yeah. It's so weird that you're actually. With your button sending a command out to the internet to servers somewhere in Sweden, and they're going, turn on the lights in Alex's studio.
The funny thing, the way it's wired, though, my wife can't, she doesn't know how to turn the lights on and off. You know, they're all wired.
Right, because she doesn't have your watch.
And so I was in LA, and she goes, hey, you left your lights on. I said, just wait a second. And I just hit my phone, and all the lights turned off.
That's the single reason to get home automation working, just so you could do that.
I'll just turn them off from here. Yeah, exactly.
I want to get the TV set up like that because I get frequent calls from Lisa saying, I just want to watch TV. How do I do that? Because there's four remotes.
I haven't figured that one out. Yeah.
The sequence. And I use CEC, you know, the trigger, the thing. And and for some reason, the Apple TV always wants to take over. So if she wants to watch TiVo, the cable, she has to keep press TiVo on the receiver like 8 times before the Apple TV finally gets, okay, fine. So,
you know, the easiest thing to do is I just have everything run through Apple TV, and then all I have to do is turn the TV on and pick up my controller.
How do you get your TV? But you don't have cable, that's why. You're a cord cutter.
I have YouTube.
Yeah, so we have YouTube TV. I should just.
Yeah, so if it's not on YouTube TV, I don't.
I keep saying, Elisa, you know, in 1 year, we're going to cut off Comcast. In 6 months, we're going to cut off Comcast.
I'm just waiting for Frontier to get here. So that's because we have Xfinity or whatever, and it's horrible. And Frontier now, they've been tearing up our road.
Oh, I don't know if I would feel like thrilled about Frontier. Away. Maybe they've turned around. They
two
were terrible.
Gig symmetrical.
Frontier fiber. Yeah.
Yeah. Frontier fiber, 2 gig symmetrical. So
I'd go for that. I could go for that. What are you, Andy? You sound like you must be on dial up.
No,
kids and your fiber.
No, I'm on Verizon Fios, and it works great. The problem is I know that it's been a while since I've basically renegotiated that menu to upgrade my internet. So I know that for the amount of money that I'm paying right now, I could probably be getting double the speed. But it's every time that I try. Oh God, I just hate that website so freaking much. I've the last time I tried it, I was screenshotting every step of the way and noticing that I don't want to spend more than I'm spending right now. Great, I'll write that down, that number, and they put this little number in the corner that says, oh well, here's what your anticipated bill would be, including all taxes and services. It has to be symmetrical service. Great, okay, great. And then so it's still at the price that I was aiming at. Okay, great. So now I'll just let's get this hooked up and click the penultimate button. And says, great, your new bill will be, and it's somehow $75 more than it was in the screen before. And am I going to have to unwind all of this to figure out how you decided that you've tacked on $70 worth of extra stuff between A and B? And then I just simply realized that, okay, what I've got right now is fine for now. I'm going to get to this, but I'm just out of energy to solve this. It's the bureaucracy that gets me every single time.
No folding phone this year, probably not for next year. I did order, you know, Samsung had its event last week, and I ordered the Flip 5. I'll have that a week from Friday, so we'll have it in 2 weeks for Mac Break Weekly. Just to show you, I think there's some interest. I mean, Lisa would love this Flip. She says, I can't wait to play with it. I wish it was an iPhone.
Yeah, the flip phones are really where the action is right now, because right now it's the only place where you can walk in with the same amount of budget you would for a premium smartphone and walk out with a folding phone. You can still, for $1,000, you can get a phone that's pretty much exactly like what you would get in an $800 smartphone on any platform. Not only does it fold in half, which makes it like a chunky folded phone, but at least something you can stick in more pockets and more purses. But also the form factor of having like a separate external display that can act sort of like an Apple Watch, you know, like that can basically be showing you a widget, when really all you need on your desk at this moment during a meeting is, I just want a widget that's keeping track of the time, or that will very, very quickly flash that, oh, by the way, here's the next thing that you need to address in 15 minutes, or here's your next appointment. There's a lot of room for design innovation that goodness, you just want to see what Apple would do with that. And I think that the prices are now coming down where it's actually a practical thing. I would absolutely love to see a traditional folding iPhone where I could either have an iPad mini or a conventional iPhone, but not at like $1,800 where I can Andy, you could have an actual iPad mini and an actual iPhone. And because right now large scale folding phones, they're almost as good as a tablet, and they're almost as good as a regular smartphone, but there are compromises on both, and that's not worth $1,800 to me. But realize that now Samsung has to be applauded after absolutely just falling into a canal with the first release of their folding phone. Now they're on generation 5, and I wouldn't say they've got every single problem worked out, but now you no longer have to be a technology forward person in order to invest in one of these phones. You just have to be a person who can make a really good case for, I occasionally need a bigger screen just for 5 or 10 minutes several times during the day. It doesn't merit me having a separate mini tablet with me. It doesn't merit having a laptop with me. But this ability to really rocket through some spreadsheets or rocket through some documents I need to process those several times a day that I need them, that to me is worth a $600 to $700 premium. And they will sell you a very good working phone that is... And I was, is it actually IP68 resistant, or is
no?
It
it's IPX8, and there's no dust resistance. They got a big X, but not Elon's X, just a regular X in there. Yeah,
but at least you don't have to worry about, oh, I need to get a ride share, like, and it's raining, it's drizzling outside. I have to worry about like little raindrops hitting it and getting in between a seam, and then suddenly, boom. Another $1,800, please.
Yeah, and I think they're getting better at dust resistance. I mean, I know they would love to be IP68, but, you know, I think they're getting...
Imagine reviewing a phone and just writing about hinges. Like your columns for Yankee Magazine for the Earl Peruse. Like, well...
about the hinge.
The thing is, you're trying to use a double-lap steel hinge when what you want is a single hoop ridge over there, because it's a chest of drawers. And, boy, if you don't want to have to be fixing those screws every 2 years or so...
Our show today brought to you by ZocDoc. You know that feeling? Oh, boy. I've had this feeling. Well, you finally find the thing you've been searching for on the internet after spending hours of researching. You read all the reviews. You finally find it. Whatever it is, you know, that thing. The disco pants that sparkle. The designer dog hoodies. The little pouch to put the kitten in. Whatever it is, it checks all the boxes. It has 5 stars. Arrives in 48 hours. Why is it that you can get a pouch to hold your dog, but you can't get a physician, a doctor, that way? Why is it, you know, it could take forever to get an appointment, not to mention, how do you know if they're even good? We got reviews for everything else. There is a way now. It's called ZocDoc, a place to find and book great doctors who have amazing reviews, and many of them with appointments in 24 hours. So if you're a little under the weather, you can get help right now. ZocDoc is free, by the way. Free, free, free. It's a free app, iOS or Android, where you can find amazing doctors and book appointments online. We're talking about booking appointments with thousands of top-rated, and this is important, verified patient review doctors and specialists, dentists, chiropractors, all kinds of medical professionals. You can filter specifically for the ones who take your insurance or are located near you, who treat almost any condition you're searching for. And every one of these docs has verified reviews from actual patients. So you even can tell what kind of doctor. You know, some people want a doctor that's going to give me all the deets. you know, like what's pros, cons, this, that, the. Some people just say, just tell me the one thing to do, doc. I don't need the info. You get, the reviews will tell you what kind of doctor. The average wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between 24 and 48 hours. You'll actually get it faster than the puppy pouch. That's it. You can even score same-day appointments. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately with just a few app taps. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with the receptionist. This is the future of medical treatment. Go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. Download the ZocDoc app for free. Now, I know you go to the app store and you're smart, and you're going to, but please, if you would, just go to ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. Get the link to the app store. Find and book a top-rated doctor today. That way we get credit. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. It is fantastic. I've used it myself. To find a gerontologist, you can go. That's you can go by specialties. ZocDoc, not for me, for an elder in my family. ZocDoc.com/MacBreak. I am rapidly going to soon be the elder in my family, but until then, I was going to mention the iPad. We had a call on Sunday, Micah and I, on Ask the Tech Guys. Somebody had a sixth generation iPad and wondered if they should get the new one now or wait till October. So which iPads do we think will be updated? German says there'll be an OLED iPad, but not till next year.
What was the latest update? Was the I'm trying to think if it was the Air or the Pro.
We sent them to the Mac Rumors.
iPad and iPad Pro were updated last October.
Yes.
That means there probably wouldn't be until the spring. Although if you've got a sixth generation, I mean the 10th generation iPad, it has come a long way since then, right?
We sent them to the Mac Rumors buying guide, and they say it's neutral right now. Because is it Mac Rumors? Who is it that does the...
They look at the cycle.
Yeah.
And I would say if you've got, I mean, my gut feeling is if you've got a iPad that's that old and you want a new iPad, you should get it. Like you should get it and enjoy it rather than waiting around until next spring sometime.
Right.
I mean, if you're fine, but if you're asking the question, it says to me that maybe it's time for an upgrade and that you don't. It's not going to make a difference if it's an 8 month old iPad, right? Like it's still going to be way more than what you have right
It'll
now.
Be snappier.
It will be so much. It'll be like 8 snaps snappier
now with more snap.
He did say it was starting to lag when he was watching Netflix and things, and I think you're right. The only thing is, if you know there's one in October, which we don't. If you knew there was going to be one in October, there might be some buyer's remorse if you bought it in late August.
Right, although it would still be a huge upgrade. But yeah, my guess is that that's not on a year cycle, right? So it's not going to be in October. It's going to be in like March of next year, probably.
Other than the Mac Minis, I buy all Apple products when they're released. like that's like I just wait until Mac Minis are kind of this utility that I just keep buying, but out because I know that I'm going to get not going to do anything near what they're capable of. And so that they're so overbuilt now. They went from being really underbuilt to being completely overbuilt for what 99% people are going to use them for, that I just feel like I can buy a Mac Mini at any point in time when I need another computer. But for everything else, I kind of wait until the release happens, and then if it's a brand new build, I will not buy it first. Like I'll let the front line of people buying it. I'll give them a couple months and wait for a 0.1 release. And then, but outside of that, like with phones, with any computer that's been out for a while that they haven't really changed a major design change, I just wait until the update, and that's the time to buy because it's going to be the newest thing unless you really need it.
Yeah. Apple Insider said a foldable iPad may be sooner than you think, but I don't think it would be this year.
That is not something I would buy immediately.
And not something that somebody who's got a base model iPad is going to want.
No, that's a good point. Right? It'll be thousands. It'll be 2,000, right? Yeah. But Ming-Chi Kuo said a folding iPad with a carbon fiber stand could be released in 2024. German doubts the claims. His sources didn't mention anything about a folding iPad. So
yeah. And that's an interesting idea about what Apple would go for. Would they go for like a 12.9-inch iPad that folds for storage in your bag to the size of an iPad mini? Or would they actually be looking for something that's more like the convertible stuff we've been seeing from Windows manufacturers where, yes, it's a tablet, but if you can fold it into tent mode and have sort of like a half-sized easel sort of thing, or even have one surface for controls and user interface, the other surface for actual content. I don't know exactly how Apple would want to go about that.
And they've been experimenting with, according to Gurman's reports, with laptops using folding technology. Now, laptops already fold, but foldable displays to do something, and I don't know whether that's just to have a much larger external display that is a computer that you could then just attach a peripheral to, or whether that's more like they want it to be sort of a tablet when it's not a laptop, is unclear as well. I mean, going back to the iPad, that buying question for a moment, I just wanted to point out, the 10th generation iPad was a major hardware update from the 9th generation. They lost those big bezels at the top and the bottom. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, the next one, when it does come, is not going to be very different, right? Because they just refreshed it. So I think that they still sell the old one for $329. That maybe I wouldn't buy unless you absolutely want to spend the least on an iPad right now. But that new 10th generation one is pretty great. And it's not going to get, even if it was coming out this fall, like it's not going to be much. They might update the chip a little bit, but that's about it.
Yeah. You might. I said, just be warned. You buy it now, you're going to be enjoying it for a few months. Then you might see a new one. You might go, aw. But
life.
That's life. That's what happens in technology. Now, I am a fan of the iPad mini, and according to the leaker Shrimp Apple Pro, gotta trust Shrimp Apple Pro, an iPad mini could be in the works for this fall.
Yeah, that hasn't gotten a rev in quite a while.
It's been a while, and that's a great form factor. I think people might eschew it, saying, well, I already have a phone that's 6 inches. What do I need a 7-inch iPad for?
Also remember that will work with the Apple Pencil and also with like crayon type devices. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty hot form factor.
It works with the Pencil too. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good. And not since September of 2021, right? So time's probably coming for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have several iPads, right? But there's something about the mini. That's the one I go to much more often than the iPad Pro, the 12-inch, 12.9-inch.
I want an iPad that's as powerful as my regular iPad Pro, or excuse me, as useful as my iPad Pro, if not necessarily as powerful. But it can be something that's in my bag, and I don't even necessarily, I have to kind of look for it when it's there. Whereas with my iPad Pro, love it. It's made its money back for me several times over. But on my regular size satchel, like my Ford Prefect style satchel, I do have to like make sure I put it in there first to make sure that I can get it in there, because once I put other things in there, it might be hard to extract.
Always put the towel underneath, I think, the iPad, so that it's got some cushion when you put it down.
As long as I know where it is, that's fine.
He's the druid that always knows where his towel is. The French zut alors are hopping mad. Oh, about my accent. No, they're mad because Apple shockingly uses advertising data to sell ads.
What?
Shocking. What is wrong with you, Apple? This is not the only complaint out of the EU. Google got in trouble too. It's kind of how everything works. You don't just throw an ad at somebody. You try to throw an ad at somebody who might be interested in your product. I mean, we can't track who's watching this show. So our ads, well, actually, that is different because we're starting to use, and you'll see in the third ad spot on this show, direct ad insertion. And they at least know what geographic location you're from. I've had people tell me they've listened to our shows in Spain and received Spanish language adverts, which is, to me, is working, right? That's what you want.
Yeah.
And when that happens, they still don't know a lot about you. They just know what IP address you have, which and geolocate you based on that. The statement of objection, it targets Apple's practices in the sector of app distribution. This came out today. Apple's accused of abusing its dominant position by implementing discriminatory, non-objective, and non-transparent conditions for the use of user data for advertising purposes. The issue is that Apple has first-party information. So they of course, they have ATT. By the way, Apple also got in trouble for ATT. I can't remember which country that was in the EU. But Apple, the reason they got in trouble for ATT was, oh, yeah, you block tracking for other people, but not yourself.
Which shows you a clear misunderstanding of what first party and third party.
So that was in Germany last year. Germany's antitrust watchdog opened a probe into Apple's advertising technology, claiming the firm's terms of use unfairly favor Apple's own services. That's just crazy. EU antitrust officials are looking into whether the firm has restricted access to the NFC to their own Apple Pay, not other payment systems. There's also a long-running probe into how Apple may have hampered music streaming companies like Spotify from telling users about deals outside of the App Store. This is that, you know, you can't have a link to your own store in the app.
Right. I mean, some of these are ridiculous, but some of these are not entirely unreasonable, right? Like, some of these are investigating the idea that Apple has defined fairness and privacy and all of these things as being a bond between the user of a phone and Apple, because Apple makes the phone. And it leads down a lot of, and that's not unreasonable on one level, but it leads down a lot of paths, sort of like, this means that Apple can close the door on competition and then do it itself. And so you see that app tracking transparency. The knock is not that it isn't a good feature. The knock is that Apple, as the first party, has defined itself out of that and can still do targeting, right? Because it's a first party relationship instead of a third party relationship with Facebook.
Do we think that's okay? Does that let them off the hook? You know, Facebook, Google, Apple, I've mentioned this many, many times. They have first party data. They're not eschewing that.
No, And the big thing is if my understanding of AT&T, maybe it's off, but is that they can't sell that data again. Like, that's the thing that, you know, Facebook wants to do is take that data and then they want to sell it to Safeway and then they want to buy or, you know, put it on the market. And that's what the whole, like, can we sell your data is a different thing than can we use your data? That's a very different, you know, these are two different things, which, you know, most,
A lot of their competition is using it internally because it's buttressing their own products, right? They don't want to give away the store. They want people to come to Facebook or Google and sell, and they don't want to give away their data. Right. They just want to sell ads and place the ads. And the argument is that it is Apple acting like a protector, but also doing something that's anti-competitive. It's similar to saying you can't, you know, we need to take the percentage away from sales in app purchases, but what that effectively does when they launch their own bookstore is mean that only the Apple bookstore can ever possibly exist on the device because they're their own middleman there. So that, I mean, I feel like they have good reasons for doing it, but it does sometimes lead them down to the path where they're like, oh, but also this benefits us.
Facebook sells specifically, I'm looking at Facebook's Help Center, we do not sell your information. Instead, based on the information we have, advertisers and other partners pay us to show you personalized ads. And they don't want to sell it because that's the gold that Facebook has. I'm sure Google is similar. However, we know people like your ISPs and Verizon are selling data to data brokers. In fact, Congress is kind of finally, I hope they act on this, trying to shut down these data brokers, because that's really, there's the real privacy problem, which is people aggregating data and then selling it on to, by the way, not just advertisers, but to the NSA. The NSA is buying this information.
I was
the FBI, too.
I think we've talked about this before, but the thing that you really get,
China?
Palantir, of course, is Palantir is the one that really buys and moves a lot of that stuff around. And so the
Peter Thiel's company.
I was talking to somebody about, like, you know, the whole idea that you're talking to someone about something and then the next thing you know you're getting ads about it. And I was talking to someone who knew something about that and they're like, no, we don't need to listen to you talk about it. We just need, the two of you are sitting next to each other, they did a search 10 minutes later or while you were talking, and we just know that the two of you are talking, like, and not from your audio, just because you have a behavior that looks like standing from the accelerometer and you're standing right next to them. And there's a, like, and that was scarier to me than them listening to my audio, is that that's the level of which, and then they can look at the entire branch of both of you and how you relate. And that's the data level of data that's kind of floating around there. But I will say that I just think that Apple's making so much money in so many places that the advertising market is an unforced error. Like, I just feel like they should not be doing this. Like, they should just stay out. Like, this would be a lot simpler if Apple didn't do this. I feel like it's a dirty place for them to be, and that they just shouldn't go there. Like, that there's so many other places where it's a clean kill. Like, they have a clean way of doing this, and this is really messy. Like, it's just really, it's a foggy place for them to be in, and I think that they'd be smart to pull out.
Yeah, this is a paper from the University of California, Berkeley, came out a couple of years ago, Chris Hufnagel. They claim not to sell data, but Facebook and Google have paid developers with data. This is before ATT came out. The selling of your personal data is central to platform economics. Basically, by providing developers with APIs that can investigate users, they're not exactly selling it. There's no coinage being exchanged, but they are. This is how you get developers on your platform. Developers, he writes, privileged access to user data is a sale. While no money trades hands, a sale only requires a transfer of value. Sales include barters, promises to pay. In a way, it's a barter, and platforms need it. Now, I don't know if ATT changed that equation or not. Maybe it did, but Facebook and Google do not have ATT.
Right. I mean, the argument is that Apple... It's ATT is about tracking, right? It's not about selling your personal data. It's about tracking you and building a profile. And what Apple wants to say is, on our platform, apps are not going to be able to do that level of tracking. So therefore, they're not watching you. So therefore, you should feel better.
Right.
At the same time, and we've talked about these stories here over the last year and beyond, Apple knows a lot about you itself. And Apple doesn't consider that a problem. Apple says, well, no, you already have a relationship with us, and and we know what apps you buy and all of those things, and we'll feed you ads in the App Store based on your behavior in the App Store and all of that. And that's just, you know, that's your relationship with Apple. That's not a random relationship. And while I think there is some accuracy in that philosophy, by banning one, you know, company or one set of companies' business and then ramping up its own advertising machinery, like Alex said, it's a bit of an own goal, because now it doesn't sound like you're doing it just to protect the user. You're also then filling the vacuum with your own profit-making apparatus, which is why I mentioned something like the Kindle Store not being able to be on Apple's platforms, or, you know, you name it. There are lots of places where Apple does something that is right, I think, and is a good idea. And then they say, oh, and you know, now there's nobody there except us, so we can make more money that way. And that's when it starts to get weird. And that's when I see some of these European regulators step in and I say, yeah, maybe so. Fair enough.
Yeah, there are a lot of areas like this is one of the few real vulnerabilities that Apple has, that they really have to be held to account to say that, okay, your answer to the question, you're only allowing your own products to have this access to this piece of hardware inside the iPhone. You're not allowing anybody else to have it, and even music services and other services that you are directly competing with. And your explanation for why you should do that, why you can do that, shouldn't be, oh, well, you can trust us. Like, no, you're going to have to prove in a court that what you're doing is okay. And then you're going to have to prove to people who are very, very skeptical, and people who, in principle, don't want to have you do that. So, as usual, Apple might be right, Apple might be wrong. The only thing that I know for sure is that they should be forced to explain themselves and not just simply say, oh, we're just two hippies in a garage. We want to improve the world for everybody. It's like, okay, but you're also two $2 trillion company, and we trust us is not going to be legally binding in the EU.
From a pure marketing point of view, all Apple has to do is be better than the other guys. So they don't have to be perfect. They just have to be a little bit. I mean, I think you're right, Alex, when you say Apple has a relationship with its customers.
And it's a relationship that most of their customers want.
We buy Apple devices because we don't mind them having that information. We just don't want Google to have it.
Well, it's not, and Google gets it every time you use a Google product. They still allowed to have that because you've defined your relationship. What
Google actually pays Apple $15 billion a year so that you will continue to use Google search in Safari.
Right. But the difference is what Apple's saying is that if you as a user approve that, that's fine. But if you don't approve it, it basically says they can't take your data and then give it to somebody else that you don't know. Like, that's the big thing, is that you're allowed, you know, Apple's allowing you to give data the companies that you've approved to have your, you know, that you've said, I'll give you my data, my tracking data, my whatever the data is. But you have to approve then as well as a user that they can take that data and run with it and give it to somebody else. That's the thing that Apple's cut off, is that you can't. So the reality is that they're not, they truly aren't doing anything different than what they're giving other companies the ability to do. You know, that first party data, if you're using Facebook, that first party data is still something that Facebook can do. It's the repackaging of your data that Apple has turned off. So that's what everybody's, you know, upset about, is that they, you know, and Apple saying, and the user just has to approve it. Like they prove it has to approve that you can sell my data to other people, and 75% or 80% of the users say no. And I think that what I will say is that I think that it's good for, you know, from a user perspective, I want Apple to say, do you want to use this, or do you want them to do this or not? And if I say yes, then more power to them. But most people are going to say no. But I still think that, even though I think that Apple's right in that area, in the ATT area, I think it'd be a lot cleaner for them and there'd be a lot less trouble. I mean, I think Apple's biggest concern over the next decade, and I've said this over and over again, is antitrust. It's the governments. It's no longer, they're not competing with their peers anymore. It's their peers trying to slow them down. You know, and the problem with the EU is they have nothing to lose. They don't have any of these companies that hold any of these platforms. And so they're kind of free run to make whatever laws they want, because it's not going to affect any of their companies.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happens whenever you've got a monopoly. You have nothing to fear from the competitors. you only have to fear the government.
Well, Apple doesn't have... They have a monopoly, a dominant position.
That's one of the things, the debates that's going on in Congress and D.C. right now, is do you have to have 100% or 90% market share to be a trust?
But Apple's not even close to that.
No, I know. Apple's and they're 50. Saying, no, but you can be dominant enough in a market that you need to be reined in a little bit. I mean, they're literally looking at breaking up companies at this point. What was it? Was it Google? Who would they want to break up?
Yeah, Google's AdSense. Google's ad business is very close to being broken up.
Yeah.
Facebook is being pursued to divest themselves of their chat app, their Instagram, everything. So, yeah, the U.S. isn't being terribly effective in antitrust that way, but the EU certainly is.
Yeah. One of the things Apple was a story, and I don't have it in front of me, was that Apple was going to demand developers ask for permission before they start using, I do have it in front of me, APIs. App Store to require developers to describe why their apps use certain APIs. I think this is a good thing, right? This is the next step after intents, because didn't you have to, don't you have to, as a developer, say, we're going to use this, this, and this. This is these intents. Apple says to prevent the misuse of certain APIs that can be used to collect data about users' devices through fingerprinting, you'll need to declare the reasons for using these APIs in your app's privacy manifest. This will assure the apps only use these APIs for their intended purpose. And that's, by the way, in the face of Google looking like they're moving towards a replacement for cookies that is a really kind of a dire fingerprinting technology. Yeah.
You talk about own goals. I mean, they're trying to fix a problem of, we want to maintain control over how ads can be trapped and hidden on browsers across the internet. We're going to do it by disguising it inside a proposal for a way to keep the internet more private and secure. And one of those offshoots is going to be that any code that runs inside that browser can say, I'm not going to execute the code on this site unless you have this ad blocker turned off, which I am now available. Oh goodness.
Yeah. Gracious. This is Ron Amadio's article in Ars Technica. If you want to read more about it, I know it's not a Google show, but this is why we buy iPhones. Google's nightmare web integrity API wants a DRM gatekeeper for the web. It's just a proposal, but it's coming to Chrome. So in a way, they call it the web environment integrity API. And in a way, it's sort of like Apple asking developers, well, why do you want to know this? The difference is Google's saying you should use this.
Apple is always in a great position because they never have to defend the idea that what we're doing is we make 80% of our money off of advertising, and what we're trying to do is make sure that that nest egg never goes away.
Yeah.
And so this is why, when you look at one of the things that you have to look at with Meta's Threads app is, goodness gracious, what a great tool Apple has given the entire community by saying, by the way, here is the nutritional value of all the privacy stuff going on with this app. And Threads is a Christmas tree of every single thing.
They want your health information.
Yeah. And it really is all about, well, the principle in Facebook that if this information we want it, but also because as you mentioned, fingerprinting, the more data it has, the more it can identify your device despite whatever's going on. So if Apple is now saying, okay, we understand why you need the ability to write information to the screen and to access to the camera. Everything else, we're going to have a long lunch about this, and you're going to have to explain to us why you need health information.
Oddly enough, though, that information came out when Threads came out, and 100 million people signed up in the first week anyway. So,
yeah, but I think that the thing with Threads is I think a lot of people were like me, which is like, I just want to protect everybody I talked to was when we were talking about office hours.
Yeah, because they're saying the usage went way down.
I just want to grab my make sure that I don't lose my handle. Right. And then so you just go up there, claim your handle, and then leave. And that's what...
You don't have to do that, it turns out, because it's your Instagram handle. You already have it.
Instagram handle, yeah.
I think a lot of us
don't like my Instagram handle. I'm stuck with it.
So there's a nuance to this issue with Apple asking for, disclosures is, are people reading the warning labels? Maybe not. But what they are doing is app developers are making basically a legal claim under the rules of the developer agreement that what they are submitting is true. And what that does is it puts a little added pressure on them because Apple can reject their apps, pull their apps from the store, kick them off the store. And so it is an honor system, but it's also this like, we caught you in a lie. And so you better tell the truth, because if we catch you, we are all powerful and we can destroy you, right? Yeah. Like that's sort of what the dynamic is there. So it's not the labels are there, but the labels also serve as you claimed this, did this. And so the new thing about having the reason why you use these new APIs that is coming, where you're going to say, like, why do you want to know about the creation date of a particular file or how long the system uptime has been on, which is very much the same idea as browsers used to, or websites used to look at what fonts were in your browser and use it to fingerprint you. And so now Safari lies about what fonts you have because they're trying to protect you from that. It's a little like that, where you could say, no, we're using that for good. But you have to know that if you're using it for evil and somebody notices, Apple is going to say you are in violation of your developer agreement. The problem with this story is that one of the APIs that they listed is literally how you say preferences. And that means that unless they change that rule, every single app in the App Store is going to have to submit one of these and say, I use it to say preferences, which is dumb. So I hope that they make some tweaks there because nobody wants to do that. And it will serve nobody if everybody is filing a generic boilerplate statement that just says, I use the preference saving API to save preferences. So we'll have to see about that. But I do think that is part of it here is it's like you're in a legal agreement with us. Don't lie to Mr. Apple, right? Like, don't do it. Don't do it.
Well, and everyone's trying to figure out how to get around this and how to get data from people at every moment. And I think that the GDPR as well, like when you do the, like, I'm not going, because I never agree to any of the GDPR stuff. I always turn it off and I always get frustrated with sites that like try to hide it behind something or whatever. And that's gotten to be easier. But when you open it up and you like open up PG&E and it's like, can we sell your data? I'm like, really? Like, really? PG&E is selling my data? Like, I can't say that word.
The one that got me was every time I close Zoom, I now in the beta of Sonoma, I get a pop-up that says Zoom would like, and it's a system pop-up. So it's like Zoom would like access to data from other applications on your system. And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? Right. And I love that disclosure because they're giving you the action of being able to say no, like, which, no, of course, you can't have it.
Of course, I use tons of data between other things to control Zoom. That's like a Zoom OSC.
Sure.
I need to be able to talk to Zoom. So it's saying Zoom wants something from other, but what it's asking for is other apps, like the ones we use that I use all the time are accessing Zoom.
Just let me choose. Right.
Exactly. And so the thing is that it is what we're seeing is a multi-year, very slow cinching of privacy. Apple is not doing this all at one time. And every year they're just going to keep on turning that screw to close it off because they've got nothing to lose. You know, they're not, you know, and they know that they can. This is a key competitive thing because Google can't do that. Like Google is based on your data. So that, you know, so Apple knows that it can just keep on turning the screw and there's, and the Android platform can't do what they're doing. And that's going to be, you know, people are going to make choices about privacy.
And then there's the members of Congress who are writing Apple to say, your app store is threatening Web 3.0.
Really? Did they really say that?
Yeah, yeah, in a letter, this is so ridiculous, addressed to Tim Cook, U.S. House of Representatives Gus Bilirakis and Jan Schakowsky have expressed concerns that Apple's App Store policies might hinder the growth of the cryptocurrency sector. They are the chairman and ranking member of the House Subcommittee on Innovation, Data, and Commerce, so they're not nothing. They said Apple might leverage its App Store rules for undue competitive advantage. I think somebody ought to talk to these guys about Web3.
Mr. Chairman, my grandson tells me that the cryptography is now money and that the Apple is against the money. And
tech
I find
giants.
This outrageous, and I demand that we send them a letter.
This is from a website called beincrypto.com, so you can see where they stand. Tech giants in hot water over NFT policies.
Hot water.
The representatives highlighted the discontent expressed by companies like Coinbase and Axie Infinia. Due to Apple's policies, Coinbase suspended NFT transfers for its iOS wallet users in the past year. Axie Infinity had to scale back NFT functionalities on iOS to align with Apple's guidelines. Oh, dear.
This is the idea that you're using NFTs to launder money outside the App Store so that you don't have to use App Store, Apple's 15%. That's what that story is coming from, is the idea that they were selling NFTs and using it to get around the 15% Apple tax. Or the 30% Apple tax, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most of the questions are about gas fees and doing NFT transactions. And yeah, it's for skullduggery sort of stuff. But also, if you have assuming that a legitimate banking app for NFTs and trading app is created, it would also apply. Most of the questions that they're asking are the very, very common questions that Apple tends to get asked, which is about, tell us everything about the App Store policy, about the approval process. Do you check every app as it comes in for whether it follows app policies, or do you only do it when there's a complaint about it? So you've also sneaking in some stuff about, hey, you gave Baidu like a fast track to approval process, which need I remind you, Baidu is a Chinese communist company, a country. Explain exactly why you did that?
This is so ridiculous. We request information and documents from Apple regarding policies in place. This is the letter governing Apple's iOS App Store and how these policies are impacting American leadership in emerging technologies, including blockchains, non-fungible tokens, and other distributed ledger technologies.
Probably the first time they ever used those words. They're like, really excited. God. We're not using the words that the kids use, you know. But
Apple
has used its
App Store guidelines to increase its own profits and reduce the utility of apps in blockchains, NFTs, and other blockchain-related technology. Yeah, the gas fees are certainly a part of it. Yep.
Yeah, I don't think it's 100% silly. I think it's up there. But if imagine a future world in which there is actually legitimate use of blockchains. Should Apple basically say that anytime there's and gas fees are not just profit taking. They are, here is the expense of actually doing this work on a blockchain. Is Apple going to say that, oh, well, since you transferred like $5,000 from one account in your bank to another account in one of your other banks using your banking app, we're entitled to 30% of whatever fees had to be charged in order to make that happen. It's not a one-to-one analogy, but the letter was signed by two bipartisan members. So it's If there's silliness, it's silliness on both sides. So it's not.
It's bipartisan silliness. Like, I will grant you that. Yes.
Too crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's too crazy. I mean, you can find a wild hair in both parties. In fact, a lot of them.
Oh, no, so no. I'm saying.
The fact that it's bipartisan, I love that they have to find one crazy kook on one side and another crazy kook on another. Usually they go to Missouri. What's that guy's name? Josh Hart.
Oh, Josh Hawley is crazy. Well, yeah.
So you can always find him on those crazy ones. Like, he's like, hey, we'll go into the Ozarks and get one guy. I know this guy. Well, he's got a thing. He's got a little shack.
Well, these two are the co-chair of the committee. The Democratic rep is from Illinois, the Republican rep is from Florida.
Here's another great bipartisan one.
Some of these questions are valid.
When you get Lindsey Graham and Elizabeth Warren in the same barrel, you know you're doing something right. When it comes to big tech, enough is enough. This is a
op-ed. I'm sure they're right on the cutting edge.
Op-ed piece.
Warren? No.
They want to practically programmers.
She's
sharp.
She's smart. I agree with her. But they want to start a government regulatory commission to regulate big tech. Basically, they said FAA, FTC, FCC, we need to regulate big tech. And it should be, this is the Digital Consumer Protection Commission Act, independent bipartisan regulator charged with, get ready for this, licensing and policing the nation's biggest tech companies. In other words, in order to start a tech company, you'd have to get a license from the federal government.
We have found, this is what this is saying, we have found that we cannot effectively pass laws, you know, in Congress. So we would like to create an agency that is no longer has to pass laws. It can just make rules. That's what they're saying.
But at the same time, the Supreme Court is undermining that capability. So I don't, you know, yeah, I don't know what this
it's
is.
Not, it's not like, I mean, the FTC has had the most gung-ho, and the DOJ have had one of the most gung-ho antitrust people, and they've been able to get absolutely nothing done just on principle of Congress saying, yeah, but that seems as though like you have power, and we would rather have that power for ourselves. So we're going to make sure that you can't actually do that.
I do think we need privacy regulation. I completely agree with that. And they need to shut down the data brokers. That's clearly a problem. And instead of worrying about TikTok, worry about data brokers who are then selling that information from all of our apps onto China. That's the real threat to our privacy, not TikTok. But it's a lot easier to go after TikTok than it is to actually deal with the problem.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems with policy. People are afraid of like the big predators, like the wolves and the tigers and the panthers, like ripping apart parts of people's bodies and, you know, eating them. It's actually the tiny, tiny little bugs that reduce a body into dust. And those little bugs, those little insects.
It's the cockroaches you got to worry about.
Those are, the million little marketing companies that are actually your biggest problem.
Turns out mosquitoes kill a lot more people than most.
Absolutely,
So,
mosquitoes and hippos.
I was disappointed to find that horses kill more people in Australia than anything else. That's,
what kills?
Horses kill more people in Australia than anything.
Horses, other than the tail end of a horse.
They've
got more deadly.
I know. It's disappointing. Take some of the allure out of Australia.
Like, stay away from the back of a horse.
Come on, snakes, get to it. What are you doing? Kangaroos, snakes, you're letting us down.
They got good poisonous snakes and spiders.
He got a takeout submarine sandwich. He didn't take. He was supposed to take the bread apart to make sure there wasn't a ring-tailed octopus hiding in there, the most deadly venom known to humanity. You know, you're gonna come to Australia. You got to play by Australia's sandwich rules, man.
If you had said drop bears kill more people in Australia than any other animal, then I would have liked it.
Killing us with cuteness.
Android. Speaking of tracking, Android and Apple have made a deal to warn you about Bluetooth trackers traveling with you. Google made a big deal about announcing it at Google I.O., and they are working with Apple. They announced their intention to draft an industry-wide standard focused on how users could be alerted to unwanted tracking. There's a problem with Android because you have to actually run an app to see an AirTag. So I'm reading this great article. I'm thinking, yeah, right on, good. And then I get to the last paragraph. Today, however, Google says this update is on hold. The decision was made to roll out these updates because Google is now working in partnership with Apple to finalize the joint unwanted tracker alert specification by year end. So they had something they were going to roll out and find my device on Android, but they decided.
I always wonder what it's like for someone, a baggage handler nowadays, because like I
know where my bags are at all times.
I know where all my bags are all the time, you know, and I'm like, oh, it's on its way out. And then it does seem like a lot of them have turned off the tracking, like on their phones. So they've made it so you can't, they're not going
to
pass.
Oh, do you
the
think
data.
they, cause yeah, cause you need to be near an iPhone to know where.
So I know that it's landed with me because there's enough people with iPhones that are on the plane that as it's going out, it tells you, oh, your bag is here. But I used to be able to know when it first came out,
where
I'd be like a Dulles.
And
I could see where in the bag. Like there was this one point where FedEx told me they couldn't find my bag. And I was like, it is in the northeast corner of your LAX thing, you know, and I know. And he's like, oh, I know where that would be. Yeah. So I was like, oops. You know, and so I had 10 of them. I had 10 little trackers all sitting in this little bundle.
I was so impressed. That United Airlines baggage handler was so worried about my camera bag being left overnight in their storage locker that he took it upon himself to take it to his own house to make sure that no one would steal it.
All right, let's take a little break. More stories to come. It turns out there was a lot to talk about. Thank you, everybody, for putting in your little stories. I got one I think Andy put in just a second. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Oh, we love ZipRecruiter. Yes, we do. If you're hiring, it is hard to acquire top talent. You're competing with every other company trying to hire that same person. And with the current labor market conditions, it is even harder than ever. That's why you want a partner who not only gets it, but works on your behalf to get you the right person for that job opening. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter knows it's tough right now, but they figured out a solution to all the problems we small businesses and big businesses are facing. See for yourself. Right now, you could try them for free. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. We use ZipRecruiter when we've got an opening. Of course, that's always a crisis in a small company like ours. That means everybody has to work harder to fill in the gap. And of course, there's this whole process you have to go through to find somebody. You don't want to just hire anybody off the street. You want to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter is ready to tackle these challenges. First of all, with ZipRecruiter, you reach more of the right people because your job posts to 100-plus job sites. But then what about this issue of competing with other companies also trying to hire the best people? Well, you're going to love this. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds matches for your job, and it does it sooner. ZipRecruiter will send you, hey, here's 10 people that fulfill your requirements. You look through them. And you invite the people that you really want to apply to your job. That gets them in your door. That gets them coming to you. They're flattered. You get first in line to hire the best people. And by the way, the pricing of ZipRecruiter, very affordable and no surprise costs. You know before you post exactly what it's going to cost. Team up with a hiring partner who understands what you need. ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. We generally, it's within an hour or two for us. It's amazing. Lisa will post on at breakfast. Before lunch, she'll be saying, oh, I got one. Here's a great candidate. Here's a great one. Then the problem is, well, we've got too many good ones. We got to narrow it down. That's a good problem to have. You want to try it? Go to our exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free right now. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak, MacBreak. ZipRecruiter, smartest way to hire. Apple wants to know, I think you put this one in, Andy Iannocco. Apple wants to know why users are turning off conversation awareness on their AirPods Pro.
Yeah, this is associated with the beta where
I didn't know we had it. Oh, so you'd have to have iOS 17.
And a lot of people have been turning off that feature, and they've been reporting like directly from people who have been using it in 9to5 Mac and other sites, and also just regular users saying, I've got a survey asking why I turned this feature off. Does it have to do with it was more complicated? It wasn't working for me. It's not relevant to me. And that just shows what goes through like a public beta. They really want to know. They've got this whole thing wired up, and they are watching every touch, every usage of every feature to figure out. We thought this would go gangbusters, but people are actually disabling it.
That's why they do betas. So this conversation awareness, the way it works, you've got to have an updated firmware on your AirPods Pro. You've got to have iOS 17 on your iPhone. if somebody's talking to you, it lowers the music volume, it turns on transparency, and it kind of aims the microphones at the person talking to you. So they're almost like hearing aids, right? You can have a conversation without doing anything.
In theory, although I believe conversational awareness, you need to talk. I don't think that somebody else talking keys it.
It has to be a conversation.
Yeah. I got the form. I filled it out, too, and I also disabled that feature.
Why?
So I use it on an airplane. It worked great because my wife would elbow me, and I would say what's going on, and it would drop and all of that. And that was pretty cool. That was a good idea. And then after a little while, when the talking stops, it goes back up. But for me, it was like I was walking the dog, and I would tell her to stop or wait, and it would be like, oh, conversation's happening. And I had to turn it off because, like, it was hearing my voice just blurt out a word and decided that I was about to have a conversation. So that's why I turned it off. It's an interesting idea. I don't know. I mean, I wonder how much data they're looking at in these betas, because it's clear that this is a, like, machine learning model trying to interpret when there's a conversation going on. It's a really good idea. I actually would use it when I'm out of a dog walking context more, but it's got some issues, and it looks like what I love is that they rolled it out and then they're like, Can we push a form to everybody asking them why they don't use this feature? And they did, and they collected data. Good. I've never seen that before.
That's the way it should be done. One of the choices in the survey, if you've turned it off, is how would you like us to make it better? Disallow conversational awareness from activating when I speak to myself or sing.
Yeah. Or my dog. Yeah, I think that there is some truth.
Actually, some truth if you sing along to music and it turns the music down, that is not what you want. I have to say, most of the time, I don't want to hear what people around me are saying. That's why I turn on noise cancellation and turn up the music. And so I could see that's why I would turn it off is like, well, I'm trying to.
I mean, I could see
listen.
It. You know, like a lot of times I'm in like Whole Foods with, you know, listen, you know, buying my stuff. When I get to the cashier, I would kind of like just not have to take my ears out and everything else. I mean, I just.
But you could just press
to them, and
can't you just press the stem once to stop the music and press and hold to turn on transparency? And now you have a conversation. It's not that hard.
Sure, but I mean, that's two steps, right? And if you have the ability to do, although they also have that other feature now where they're trying to like split the difference between noise canceling and transparency to make it a little more suppressed, but also some stuff bleeds through. That's an interesting feature that I'm not quite sure entirely works either. But you're listening to your music on the airplane, and then the flight attendant wants to know if you want any snacks, right? And it's kind of nice to be able to say, oh, what do you have? Oh, I'll have a Diet Coke or whatever, instead
like
of
this.
Having to be like, oh, hold on, let me take them out.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I just go, eh? What?
Eh?
What did you say, young lady?
Biscoff? Do you have the Biscoff cookies?
Biscoff? Love the Biscoff.
Sir, this is not Delta. We don't have those here.
I do love the Biscoff, I admit.
I will admit that my habits on the plane have changed dramatically, in the sense that I think that I used to look for that cart to come down and figure out when I was going to get something. And now I buy something before I get there. Yeah. I have a couple of things of water. I used to sit on the aisle. Now I sit on the window, and I literally don't interact with anyone.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
no, I'm that way.
Like in a way that I was a little more social before. Now I like, I don't care about anything.
I take off my shoes and socks, put my feet up on the back. I bring usually about a dozen hard boiled eggs. I slowly peel them.
Hard boiled eggs. Do you have that with a little bit of your Limburger cheese?
And a little Limburger cheese. It's so good. And it really takes the sting out. Oh, here's my Biscoff. Thank you, flight attendant. They brought me some Biscoff. Isn't that nice?
That's the secrets of the Twit studio, is that there are ample supplies of Biscoff cookies out in the hallway.
But they're hidden. We're the Delta Airlines of podcast networks. You know where
they are. I know where they are, Leo. I absolutely know where they are.
There used to be a whole bucket of Tootsie Rolls, remember?
There still is a bucket of candy. Debbie maintains that.
It was just Tootsie Rolls for a while.
Yeah, well, sometimes we go through phases, don't we? Yeah, exactly. For some reason, somebody's really into Slim Jims. There's a massive box, not just of normal size Slim Jims.
Lisa.
These are this big. They are 3 yard long Slim Jims. Is that Lisa? Is that my wife?
Yes.
They are really good. They're just really not pretty.
You got to wonder what's in those things, though.
I love eating nitrates.
Are they bull pizzles? I mean, what are they, really?
All the stuff left
sticks
over.
Sticks of nitrate.
Sticks of nitrate and salt. No, yeah,
Lisa, Randy the Lisa. Macho Man is endorsing them. That's all
pink
I need.
Pink slime.
Could you? Could I have a giant bull pizzle to eat with my Biscoff cookies? No. Okay.
Yuck. Ew. Don't do that.
All
Don't
right.
sully the Biscoff. How dare you?
I'm sullied. Oh, here comes my wife. Huh?
It's just junk food.
It's just junk food. Nothing wrong with junk food.
You eat hot dogs.
Oh, she's brought out the big guns.
He's pulling
what
out
is
the big
more
guns.
American than a hot dog?
A Come hot on. Dog's all American. It's true. Probably.
It's not apple this, pie and this, Slim Jims, I'll tell you that.
This is this week in ADHD.
All right, back to the stories. This one's for you, Alex Lindsay. Pixar, Adobe, Apple, Autodesk, and NVIDIA have formed an alliance, the Alliance for Open USD. What is this and why?
Yeah, so, I mean, this gets back into something we've discussed in the past, is that when you, whatever you control, whatever you're making money on, you want to control, whatever you're, is going to cost you money or make it hard for you, you want to commoditize.
Yeah.
And for all of these, you know, so when you see a bunch of big corporations wanting to get an open platform, what they want to do is make this easy for all of them to pass stuff between themselves and not have it be expensive or painful and not have a lot of roadblocks. USDZ is the universal scene description. This was created by Pixar to move whole scenes. So it doesn't just move the models. It moves models, lighting, animation, textures, surfaces, all of those things from one place to another. It was made it very portable internally. Apple then moved it forward a little bit. And USDZ has been slowly rolling out to replace things like FBX and other things that have been used in these formats. But Apple then created USDZ, which was just zipping that file up so that you could move things around. But now they're kind of, I feel like they're backing away from USDZ and really just going towards you, because it's hard to get that support. And so I think that they're going, like, we'll just go back to USD, but they're gaining support from basically all the major manufacturers that are doing it. Let's just all use the same format to move things between each other. And this is going to make it much easier to do things that's NVIDIA and Apple have a really vested interest, because this means that it's easy for them for their Omniverse and for the new headset and all the AR stuff to be able to get stuff in there and not have to, like, right now there's a reality converter, and that takes many other formats and converts it to USDZ for Apple. What Apple would like is people just to generate that content. It's been a real challenge for Apple to get proper generation of USDZ data for the AR stuff coming out natively. Usually you're still going through something, or it's not quite, it's like weird. I don't know if it's still this way, but for a while in Adobe Substance, you would export out something that used USDZ as a quote unquote texture map. And you'd think it would all come in pieces, but it came out with one model. But it was like almost a side product. It was just a very odd way to get it out. And so in a lot of ways, this is just an alliance for them to start really building up a centralized way. You know, it's like, let's just use QuickTime, or not QuickTime, let's use Apache, you know, or something like that, where we just want to make this easy for everybody, because that's not where we're making money. You know,
what's the difference between USD and USDZ?
Is it zip? So it's,
oh, it's a zip USD.
They just zipped it, because the problem is USDZ is really a package, and it can blow apart. So the problem, like, if you take if you save out a logic file, and it looks like a file, but if you push it up onto Frame.io, it just blows up into all the folders that were inside that package. So by zipping it and treating that zip like a true file, it makes it more, Apple realized it would make it more transportable and easier to go through things without the folders being ripped apart. So I don't know where the USDZ part of this is going, because Apple at the last WWDC talked very little about USDZ and a lot about USD. This is open USD. So I think that part of it is other folks don't necessarily want to work with that format. I think it's a little slower. I think that that's my understanding of it anyway. So, but I think it's a really good move. I think it's great that everybody's agreeing on this.
USD is at Pixar, was invented at Pixar.
But
now it's open. It's actually going to be under the Linux Foundation's JDF. That's where the project will live.
It
feels a little bit to me like the video or standards that we went through, where we had all different kinds of standards, and then we had wrappers around the standards. And
I think the difference here is that what they've learned is that they all got together and did MPEG, right? But then MPEG has all these these
patent encumbrance,
encumbrance and all these patents. And so what they're saying is, let's not do that. Let's just make it, let's just let everybody use these. Like, yeah. Let's not, because you have all these other things growing up. You know, AV1 is the next generation and it's designed to not use any of the MPEG stuff, you know. And so the, so I think a lot of people don't want to have things that are specifically encumbered by patents.
So if you, we have a beef stick for all appetites here at TWiT. We've got the mini turkey stick for people who are just want a little snack. This is the Mission Meats beef stick, kind of a medium size beef stick. Then there's the Chomps grass fed, ooh, and finished beef stick. It's all the stick without the ick, they say. But if you, here's another one, a zero sugar beef stick. This is from the new Primal. But then if you're really in the mood, if you're really hungry, you want the giant Slim Jim, the original, the one, the only. you could beat people with this and not leave a mark. All right.
I counted at least four possible show titles from that. All the stick without the ick.
They told me that this is not good, that the turkey one is not good. So don't eat that one when you're here.
I will say that all of the American stuff seems good until you have Biltong.
Biltong is good.
And once you have Biltong and Boar's Wars, you're kind of over
South
the
African.
U.S.
Rene Ritchie. The South African stuff.
When you get proper beef, like packaged beef jerky, as opposed to like the convenience store stuff, that's the stuff that, oh, this is why this bag costs $5. It's like that's like one of my two go tos when like I'm going to be at a conference like all day long. I don't know if I'm going to get lunch or not. It's like, okay, bag of beef jerky so I can just get some protein in me. That's like, oh my goodness, this is good.
Yeah.
As opposed to snapping into a Slim Jim, not my go-to.
I don't know. When I'm in the mood to bite a piece of meat, I want to go to ConAgra. And get a Slim Jim.
I mean, I'll give him this. Of all the foods that I could possibly find underneath the passenger seat of my car,
this one is going
to
keep
and still be able to eat.
Yeah,
that would be probably my go-to.
Yeah, yeah. There is a Good Wired article which the Discord has given me that you probably don't want to read, called "What's Inside a Slim Jim." This is from 2009.
That's what we've been asking Mrs. Jim for 20 years, but she just lawyers up.
Nothing but the black heart of a banker. A sergeant's hands-on Macintosh leaps to mind. Paul Thurrott's hands-on Windows for the distaff side. We're just working on a new AI show with Jason Howell and Jeff Jarvis. It'll be in the club. We start shows in the club because members pay for it. They're too small to have ads at first. But if it does well, like This Week in Space, it launches out of the club into the public eye. And that's the best success story we've had so far. So you're supporting that. You get access to the Discord, which is a great place to hang, chat, and share animated GIFs. And you also get, of course, the TWiT Plus feed, which is stuff that happens before and after the shows, extra stuff, pictures of Mr. Jim in his hat, his Slim Jim hat, all of that for $7 a month. And it keeps Lisa in Slim Jims, so that's a good thing. No, the money all goes to keeping the programming going, keeping the lights on, and paying the staff. And it is a big help. So if you want to support what we do, twit.tv/clubtwit. And you'll know what's inside a Slim Jim. So you took the blue one, John Ashley. That's the good one?
I like the blue one. I like the Chomp one as well.
Chomp.
You should eat the turkey one, though.
It's really that bad. It's called Think Jerky. I suppose Imagine Jerky.
It'll make you think about your life choices.
Zero sugar, 4 grams of protein, 25 calories, gluten-free. All of these are gluten-free. We're going to put wheat in these. Maybe ConAgra would, actually. Maybe Slim Jims aren't gluten-free. It's got a long ingredient list. All right. Andy put this one in from the New Yorker. He says, a somewhat snooty take on Apple Classical in the New Yorker this week. Apple again fails to save classical music. You said this. You should be Fraser Crane, or maybe Niles, even worse, should be reading this. It's actually Alex Ross, who's one of their reviewers. What does Alex find at fault?
He basically feels as though streaming is already an environmental disaster. Which is bad. He feels as though on the apps, music is atomized into bits, stripped of biography, history, and iconography. Even from a predatory capitalist standpoint, streaming makes little sense. Spotify has yet to turn a profit, despite generating more than $12 billion of revenue. All the same, the magical ability to summon millions of songs and symphony in the palm of one's hand has proved irresistible. The seduction of convenience wears down ethical resistance.
We like Apple. Well, we loved Primephonic, which Apple bought, put out of business, and then 18 months later came up with Apple Classical. Is it as good as Primephonic, Andy?
I'd say so. And it's hard to remember because remember they shut down Primephonic soon after they bought it. I mean, it's definitely an improvement, a needed improvement for a type of music that isn't well served by a conventional streaming app. It's not so much the service, so much as the app that expects everything to be really categorized very neatly and very cleanly with a very small number of tags associated with it. Whereas with classical music, you start off with the problem that If you try to stick a track from a classical recording into the same display user interface that was designed for pop music, congratulations! A lot of the track information is organized as, you know, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Le Nozze di Figaro, directed by blah 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 blah, and then you get to the name of the actual song, and so the aria is pretty much over with by the time the actual name of the piece of music you're actually seeing actually scrolls into view. To say nothing of the fact that there are lots of different entry points that people are looking for. So. My particular knowledge is opera and using these apps. And sometimes I want to hear specifically Joyce DiDonato, but the problem is that if I ask for everything by Joyce DiDonato, I only get like the handful of albums that she's recorded strictly as a solo artist. Even when she's done a program with Il Pomodoro d'Oro, it's like, okay, well, no, that's you asked me for Joyce DiDonato. You can't blame me for not finding Joyce DiDonato with Il Pomodoro d'Oro. Is the conductor? Is it listed as the symphony orchestra? It's kind of a mess. And so just simply having a different app that acknowledges that, okay, the queries for people trying to find things are going to be different. The interface is going to have to be a little bit different. And also for people who are not into classical, it takes a long, long time to find that entry point. It's like jazz in that sense. Where like, I heard a piece of jazz music just like, you know, on the radio or whatever. I don't listen to much jazz. Where's my entry point here? You need people who can write essays and can write playlists that will figure out, hey, here's what, if you're interested in opera, winner of America's Got Talent singing a slightly ropey version of Nessun Dorma got you interested in opera, here is like 10 tracks that will get you kind of interested in exactly what this stuff can do. So I think it's very, very good. I flag this because I just thought the attitude of someone who if most of the people who are writing essays, not even reviews about streaming music services, get into very, very practical and tactile sort of things with it. Like, oh, well, unfortunately, it makes it really hard to find this album. I can add things to my queue, but as soon as I switch to a new album, I lose that queue. He just seemed to have a philosophical, I can't put myself in the unisex crocs of a young person exploring classical music for the first time, but Apple Classical strikes me as an oddly clumsy point of entry.
He actually wrote that. I can't put myself in the unisex crocs of a young person. Alex, please.
I don't recall him putting the phrase avocado toast anywhere in here, but I would be surprised if that was in one of the earlier drafts.
Yeah.
An array of playlists called composers such as adorned with dour, sickly portraits that, according to Apple, were, quote, commissioned from a diverse group of artists, unquote. I envisioned a studio of talented girls and boys at an orphanage in rural Romania. Like, what the hell? Now you bring Romania into this? There are talented boys and girls in Romania, I promise you.
Are you sure this wasn't written by Andy Borowitz? This sounds like a parody.
again, you look at the address bar of the browser and say, nope, it's not the Onion.
No. Wow. does mention a competitor called Adagio, which is a German company. Have you tried Adagio?
No, because I was pretty much waiting for Apple Classical, and it kind of did the trick for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is not cheap. $200 a year for the premium plus concerts. They do lossless quality. They do FLAC, which is nice.
Yeah.
Of CDs.
I mean, there is an opportunity there for people who are interested in like live streaming or getting access to past live streams of like really great performances. I used to subscribe to the Metropolitan Opera has their own streaming service where almost everything that's ever been like live at Lincoln Center on the old PBS show or recorded for their modern like live and HD theater productions is now streamable. So if you've heard me like saying nice things about again Joyce DiDonato and Renee Fleming I can never locate a word when I absolutely need it. I'm sorry. But yeah, they had a premiere opera last year that was really the highlight of the season for me. And if you're interested in that, then you can go to their streaming service and actually rent it or actually use it. That's nice. But you'd have to be really, really particular, I think, to know that I want specifically this 2-hour concert program from the Opera Festival in Bayreuth from 3 years ago. Say, okay, we can do that for you. It'll cost $200 a year, and fine. If that's what you want, that's fine. But I think that Apple Classical does a really, really good job for what it needs to do.
Yeah, and I think it's going to win. He does.
The Hours. I'm sorry. The name of the opera is The Hours.
The Hours, yeah. Darn convenience. It's ruined everything. but there really is a reason to say, well, I'm already subscribing to Apple Music, and I get Apple Classical with it, is actually probably all it takes to make this a hit. Is Apple Music, Spotify's still number one, and Spotify has no classic, it has classical tracks, but it really has no real support for classical. And then Apple is right after Spotify.
Spotify has double the market of number two and number three, which are pretty much equal, which is Apple Music, and I can't remember whether the third one is YouTube.
Or Pandora? Or YouTube
Music. I think it's an actual Asian streaming service. Mm. I'd have to remind myself. But I do remember that Spotify is still somewhere in the like 40%, whereas Apple Music is hovering in the high teens, and their next competitor is somewhere like one percentage point under that, if my memory serves.
And then finally, the information piece on Apple and Goldman Sachs, how the partnership between Apple and Goldman Sachs soured. We know Goldman's been trying to sell off their all of their consumer finance products, including the Apple Card to American Express. This is a story from Lauren Tara La Capra and Wayne Ma. You wrote, Andy, I think that the piece in 9to5 Mac is perhaps a little.
It's the information piece is really good, well sourced, and it's a very good long read on exactly how complicated this relationship was and how difficult this product was to roll out. For people who don't want to, or at least want to an amuse bouche, like a little appetizer before reading it, 9to5 Mac summarizes it nicely, saying pulling out from the very, very top the fact that engineers from the Silicon Valley giant and the Wall Street titan were pulling it all night or a few months before launch, scrambling to find a solution to a problem that had cropped up. Tim Cook couldn't get approved for an Apple Card.
Oh.
And so ultimately, Goldman Sachs had to do some work behind the scenes to get the Apple CEO approved for an Apple Card.
But it was reasonable. The information says the problem stemmed from the fact that he's such a high-profile figure, he's regularly impersonated. And so if you're famous, there's a flag on your account with credit bureaus saying, make sure it's really the person. As a result, Goldman's underwriting system rejected him. This is according to four people familiar with the matter from the information. Goldman was eventually able to make a one-off exception. Tim got his card.
Yeah.
but I got to warn George Clooney, it's going to be hard for you. The information does point out that it's going to be tough for Goldman to get out of this. It can't, the information writes, offload the business without Apple's approval, which puts it in a bind because few, if any, other partners would agree to Apple's terms. American Express runs its own payment network, but the Apple Card is a deal in place to run on the MasterCard network until at least 2026. So, yeah, that might rule out American Express. Apple could even wind up partnering with a less visible bank and handling the bulk of the work itself. I guess the issue is to be a bank requires a lot of hoops to jump through. I know this from watching Billions. You can't, you have to go through a lot. And maybe Apple is just not in the position to become a bank.
Yeah, and this is the initial deal when it was first announced reminded me of the deal that Apple struck with AT&T to launch the first iPhone, where AT&T correctly saw this as a huge opportunity to, whereas they were number two behind Verizon, but a very distinct number two, and they needed, after another rebranding from AT&T to Singular, then right back to AT&T, they needed a huge hit to put themselves on the map and get their subscriber base up, and that's why they agreed to all kinds of demands that Apple was making that no other phone maker could make any movement with any existing network, such as simply, okay, we will allow you to put a real web browser on here. Yes, we will allow you to design the device yourself, as opposed to making the device that we have designed for you and that we've decided that we can support. And so it seemed as though Goldman Sachs was making the same kind of play, where at the time, a few years ago, they did want to really branch out into consumer finance products, and they thought that a partnership with Apple was going to be the way to do it. And so perhaps they agreed to a whole bunch of terms that they were taking on a lot of responsibilities that Apple never didn't really have to deal with. They were dealing with the interface, they were dealing with bringing customers there, but Goldman Sachs was left with all of the money problems and all of the infrastructure problems, and they are living to regret it. It wasn't just the relationship with Apple that's going south. Remember that this was part of a full court press towards consumer finance, and they're getting out of it entirely. They're not just simply, oh, we don't want to deal with Apple anymore. It's like, no, this was a bad play for us. They lost $1 billion
in 1 year, according to Goldman. Part of the problem is the deal wasn't great for Goldman. Goldman, unlike other credit card companies, does not take a cut of the interchange fee that merchants pay to accept the Apple Card. And, of course, as you know, the Apple Card doesn't have fees, so they can't make money from annual fees, late fees, overseas fees. In exchange, Apple pays for the daily cash rewards. The expectation was, on Goldman's side, the costs and revenue would essentially even out. But no, Goldman has lost a lot of money. Goldman does earn a fee. This is all from the information. Great piece. Does earn a fee from Apple in the high single-digit percentage range of every loan issued to cardholders who opt to split the cost of Apple products over monthly installments. Maybe this is why the buy now, pay later came along. High single-digit percentage, 8-9%. It's not the credit card money, but
I feel like, you know, Apple is still warming up to be their own bank. And I think that they're, you know, so I think the hard part is also bringing somebody else in when they are probably just a stopgap.
Tough negotiator. They talked to a guy named David Robertson, who is a publisher of the Nilson Report. He's an expert on credit cards. He says no commercial bank that's experienced in the credit card business is going to give Apple the same terms as Goldman did. It's just, which makes it just like AT&T with the iPhone, right?
Yeah, with the other difference that they're not gaining Goldman Sachs customers. They are people who are using the Apple Card may not even be terribly aware that they're working that they're clients and customers of Goldman Sachs. Whereas AT&T, they are getting new customers. The people who are buying the iPhone knew that they're AT&T customers. They're getting billed directly from AT&T. So when AT&T decides to stack more fees upon them or give them new offers, they have the ability to do that. So there's a lot about this that. I mean, yeah, obviously, we quickly hit the glass ceiling of understanding how finance operations and finance corporations works. But it did seem super, super unusual for Goldman Sachs to say, yes, we're going to enter into an agreement with Apple that no bank, no financial institution traditionally would get into when they're trying to make a play like this.
Right.
It wasn't a conservative play by any means whatsoever. It was, again, we think that this is going to be our breakthrough. This is going to be our icebreaker that gets us through that pack ice into this brand new market that we desperately at that time wanted to be in.
The piece says that Apple really wanted the card just so people would buy more iPhones and would allow them to pay off their iPhones. But some employees within Apple questioned whether the company should get into the business. They brought in a banking consultant to brief Eddie Q, the head of Apple Pay, Jennifer Bailey, about how credit cards worked. The consultant singled out a card lender that was under fire for targeting people with poor credit and extending them large limits. One person who attended the meeting said afterward Apple executives weren't sure whether they wanted to greenlight the project given the predatory nature of the credit card business. They wanted to make a credit card business that was better than that. That's what it ended up getting them into it.
Yeah, that's why I always found that, even at the very beginning, I found that odd, because as soon as people start saying, "Hey, I'm way in debt, way over my head in debt with my Apple credit card," and there's a complex season of reasons why people will get into credit card debt, but that's not a great look for Apple. And it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier, that you wonder how much money and how much opportunity Apple thought was in this business to want to do it despite all the baggage and all the problems that were going to come into play. I have the same feeling about AirTags, where how much money are they making off of AirTags that it was worth 2 or 3 years of it being synonymous with, hey, AirTag, congratulations, you got the just like people do Google searches, people used to tweet, people use Band-Aids, and now people do AirTag stalking. Like, no, that's not the free promotion we wanted. They knew there was going to be an unsolvable problem, that they could only mitigate it slightly. And it makes me wonder what kind of presentation that someone made to convince someone else that this is a big enough opportunity for us that despite unsolvable problems, we're going to take that hit because it's too much of a plus for us.
Yeah, there were a lot of negatives from Apple's point of view, and Apple did its usual thing. I mean, this is a new business for them. They did their usual thing. For instance, most credit card bills come on the date you started the credit card. Apple said, no, we want it to be calendar months. And Goldman said, what are you crazy?
Yeah.
Apple wanted cash back rewards to be credited instantly. But Goldman said, we can't do that. Credit card purchases are processed in batches and not in real time. And this is probably the most telling sentence. There wasn't much financial incentive for the outside vendor to modernize those operations.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fine line, right, between being the bumpkin who stumbles in and says, I want to do things different. And yeah, they're like, no, you don't understand. We do it this way for a reason. And the modernizer who's coming in saying, you guys are doing stupid things. You should not do them. It's bad for consumers. Let's do them a new way. And I feel like if you're Apple, and you're one of the world's biggest companies, and you got all the money in the world, and you have a very wealthy customer base, you know, you look at the financial industry. I feel like Apple does this in a lot of industries, and they're like, you know, why don't we do that? Because you start to think, let's do partnerships and let's make traditional deals. And then you look at the details of what that product would be, and you realize it's not a product you want to be associated with, right? Like, it's like, we could make a crappy Apple credit card, but it's going to be just like all the other credit cards. And why are we bothering?
Here's another example.
Why don't we just do it ourselves? And they've got the money, right? Like, let's just do it and see if we can make a change for the better.
But they still have to deal with these middlemen and all of that. Apple's, this is another example. Apple's obsession with design also meant Goldman's legal team had to determine whether certain ideas would fly with regulators. For example, card agreements typically need a 2-column box that clearly displays a card's interest rates and fees. Apple, the designers, wanted the box in a single column, since a 2-column box wouldn't display well on the iPhone's narrow screen. So it is a single column on the iPhone, although the downloadable card agreement is 2 columns.
Yeah. Stuff like that is how people with like $80,000 left on their mortgage can simply like hire a $300 lawyer to say that while you were required in this state to process this paperwork this way when you sold my loan to somebody else, you failed to do that, and therefore this $80,000 is now null and void. That's mistakes like that are why you have 2-column boxes, or why you have people who've been in this industry for 30 years and been working with people who've been in the industry for 50 years. It's tough.
And the only way, if Apple does want to find in the long run be in financial services, they got to learn. Exactly. I guess this is how they learn, and it can't hurt, essentially can't hurt them, right? Because first off, they got a partner to take the $1 billion loss, and second, they've got the money, right, to do it. And I love it. It may not work, right, but I appreciate the moxie to sort of say, wow, all these credit cards are stupid. Why can we make one better? And I don't know if they can, but they tried,
and now they have all the data. Like this is the thing, is that they have a ton of data. They have someone that they could throw under the bus. Goldman Sachs is basically the red shirt, right? So they went down to the planet with a red shirt, you know, and just said, you do this, you know, and so then they set the rules so tight that Goldman Sachs can't renegotiate that. And so I think that the issue is that they've got Goldman Sachs in this bind, but they're learning, you know, very, very quickly how to make, you know, how to make this all kind of work. And I think that, again, when you look at what's coming, you know, the, whether the AR, the headset works or not, if they actually produce a car, with all the phones and the computers and everything else, they are still the only company in the world that may get to a point where they, most of your loans are given to them and then redistributed to other people in their network. It is a closed system. And that is a crazy thing. That's a crazy concept that Apple is the only company in the world that's ever been big enough since credit cards have been out to be able to actually build something where when you borrow money from them, they're using your money to loan it to other people to buy their products. And that's going to be a regulatory nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, like, so because it's going to scare a lot of people because they're suddenly not going to need anything on the outside. So it's going to be really interesting to see, but I think that's where they're capable of getting. I don't know if they're actually going to do it or not.
Yeah. And then if you want to expand this product outside the United States, you get to start the game all over again.
Right.
Now with bribes.
Wayne Ma and Lauren Tara LaCapra write that Apple could ultimately decide not to have a big name partner and go it almost alone. People familiar with the company's thinking and potential options said the tech giant could choose a bank that is large enough to take on the Apple Card's portion of Goldman's $17 billion credit card portfolio, as well as related savings accounts. And that partner could do everything necessary for regulatory reasons, but otherwise remain invisible to the customer. Apple could become more involved with the aspects of the business that Goldman now manages. It sounds like because of, you know, banking regulations, getting a bank charter isn't just about how big you are, how much money you have, how big a brand you are.
Is that why would Apple do? Why would Apple do this before 2026? I mean, that's the hard part,
right,
that Goldman Sachs is in, is Apple can just sit on it. You know, it's mm-hmm. you know, they tighten that agreement so tight, it's like the user is not going to feel it.
No.
All the losses are going to go to Goldman Sachs. Apple has no, I don't think Apple has any reason to renegotiate this.
No, in fact, what this article wraps up saying, it's going to take time for the sides to find a new solution and dissolve their marriage, perhaps as long as 18 months. Among more than a dozen people the information spoke to about the potential outcomes of an exit, few envision a scenario where Apple and Goldman work things out, given how much pressure Solomon, the CEO, has been under. Still, on an earnings call last week, Solomon said the card partnership with Apple, as well as the one it has with General Motors, are long-term commitments that can't be changed unilaterally. They definitely can operate better. We're working with Apple and also GM to do that. So as much as Goldman would like to get out of the consumer business, it can't just pull the plug. It's going to take a while. So it's a really good story, a fascinating story. I think your best analogy, Andy, is absolutely right. This is just like the iPhone's launch with AT&T. You know, Apple got huge benefit. AT&T got the exclusive. Stevens, the CEO of AT&T, said giving Apple users unlimited free data or unlimited data forever was a huge mistake, and they deeply regretted it. It really hurt the AT&T network for a long, long time. And eventually they lost the exclusive. This wouldn't be like that. Apple's not going to have multiple banks supporting the Apple Card.
But in the end, the number of signups that AT&T got to make them on the parity, if not the...
It helped, the, right.
Yeah. With Verizon. Yeah, they are, again, AT&T was and also ran. Verizon owned them. There are a lot of different players in that market. But however, Verizon was number one. AT&T was trying to find a way to make some magic happen, and they were failing.
And finally, a kind of nice story. I remember back in 1994... when my daughter was just two and Henry wasn't even born yet, Jennifer was pregnant, we spent some time with Steve Jobs and his young family. And I remember Jennifer reading a kid's book to Reed Jobs, who was roughly Abby's age. He was a little around 2 years old. Reed's now all grown up, of course, and he has a new venture fund, Yosemite. He's got a little money. I think Reed inherited a little bit of money. So he's launched Yosemite, a $200 million venture capital firm, but with a good idea. It's aimed at cancer treatments. And of course, his dad died of pancreatic cancer. Yosemite is named after the national park where Steve and Lorene got married. They've raised $200 million from a wide range of investors and institutions, according to Apple Insider, including Sloan Memorial Kettering Cancer Center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the Rockefeller University, and MIT. They're looking to create new cancer treatments. My dad succumbed to cancer when I was in college at Stanford, said Reed. He's now 31. I was pre-med because I really wanted to be a doctor and cure people myself, but just completely candidly, it was really difficult after he passed away. It's a spinoff of the Emerson Collective, which is the philanthropic arm created by Lorene Powell Jobs after Steve's passing. So
that's my understanding that he's been doing the due diligence and talking to a bunch of people who are involved in cancer research. I think I heard through the grapevine that like he talked to Mike Milken, who's really involved in the Prostate Cancer Foundation.
Because right. Milken
and
had cancer.
Like, this is, and so I kind of love that idea that Mike Milken, who is sort of the elder statesman of cancer research, is talking to Reed Jobs, who is so young, about it's not necessarily a passing of the torch yet, but it's sort of like going down a few generations to talk about how they're going to continue funding cancer research. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's a bit of a hybrid. It will operate as a for-profit business for investments, but it's also going to kind of be a nonprofit that will offer donor-advised funds that can provide grants to scientists and researchers. Emerson Collective, of course, is a nonprofit. The donor fund will provide no strings attached grants. And then the hope is that if you got the grant and you come up with something, that you'll return to Yosemite for venture funding. It's actually a really clever idea. Reed Jobs says he wasn't initially keen on creating a VC fund, saying, quote, he'd never wanted to be a venture capitalist, but I realized that when you're actually incubating something and putting it together, you can make a tremendous difference in what assets are part of that, what direction it's going to take, and what the scientific focus is going to be. Reed did get a little education in business, because during the iPhone 4 fiasco, you're holding it wrong fiasco, Steve was vacationing at Kona Village in Hawaii and was forced to come back to manage the PR hit. And he took Reed with him. I think Reed was probably 13, something like that. And he said, come on, Reed, I'm going to show you how business works, which is pretty cool.
That would explain why he seemed so peeved, not at his own engineers.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The people who were
he was on vacation. Yeah, he was on. In fact, Kona Village at the time, it got blown away by a hurricane, I think, in Iki. But Kona Village at the time, there were no phones, no internet, no TV sets. So somebody must have sent a courier. Steve, we got a problem.
They yanked the shave ice right out of my hand. I've been looking forward to it that entire flight.
All right, we're going to take a little time out, and then it is time for your picks of the week. If you would assemble them, gentlemen, you're watching Mac Break Weekly. Let's kick off the picks of the week this week with Andy Inoko. Andy?
My pick is a really cool app that solved a big problem for me and created like opportunities for me, which is all I can ask for software and technology. It's actually just as much as I've been joking about, you know, early 1980s, like home computer as a, and mom will use it to organize her recipes. I started using the app Recipe Keeper, which is cross-platform. It's a recipe keeping app for Android, iOS, iPad, Mac, Windows. And boy, does it work really, really well. Over the past year or two, I've been trying to like up my kitchen game, because you know how you get, like you might cook something special on weekends, but then you get into the rut of 3 days a week, the same like weeknight meals, and then take out like one or two nights a week. So I've been acquiring new recipes and trying to inspire myself to try new things. And this is really a very slick solution that is aware of how many different sources you get recipes from and what you need to do with them. I just have tons and tons of bookmarks when I'm on Reddit or elsewhere about, oh, that looks like it might be simple enough to be like a good Wednesday meal. And now all I have to do is use the standard sharing sheet in whatever app platform I'm using to simply share it to Recipe Keeper. It will break it. It understands the formatting of recipes. It also understands specifically how Epicurious and other sites specifically format them. So you wind up not just bookmarking this site, but with this very, very nicely standard formatted recipe sheet with pictures taken from the recipe page and everything. And if you need to like this is serve 6, I really want it for serving 3, easily do the math for that. When you're doing shopping, if you're doing meal planning, you say, oh, I want to cook that on Thursday, and then suddenly if you when you're doing your shopping on whatever day of the week you do it, like, oh, that's right, I do need like garlic paste because I'm making that thing on Wednesday or Thursday night, and makes it really, really easy to tag these things and organize them and find them. Again, it's not as though it's using the power of ChatGPT on the blockchain to improve productivity and connectivity. It's a very, very simple task that it does extremely well. The free version is really robust, and if you give them $13, I think, for a lifetime purchase, suddenly you get the ability to sync between devices and between platforms. This came about because things got complicated enough that I started like keeping a notebook like in the kitchen with just, oh, here's sous vide, and things like, oh, well, here's how to use I can't believe that I actually had a page on here's how to use paprika, because sometimes some spices you're like,
I just throw it in by the fistful, but that doesn't always work.
Because like I was wondering why things weren't working, and then I learned that, oh, well, there's some spices you put into the pot like at the beginning of a cook, there's some spices that you put like near the end because otherwise they cook out, right, and you sort of burn them out, and so after like 2 weeks of that, I started looking at thinking that, oh, well, this is a good excuse as someone who occasionally does picks of the week and stuff like that, thinking that, okay, I'd find two or three, one of them would be kind of nice enough to recommend, but I'd be just back to the notebook. But now, yeah, that's completely supplanted it. And once again, mostly it's because I find recipes without looking for them. It's just I find it's, and now those things don't just disappear into my bookmarks folder. It's like, if I'm bored on a bus or something, I can be scrolling through and say, oh, that's right, that was that chicken stew recipe that looks crazy, stupid, simple, that it can't possibly work. I'm going to try that this week. And so it keeps it back at the front of your mind. It's helped me to up my game and go from, okay, I guess it's Wednesday night, I guess it's another pork cutlet with rice and maybe some black beans mixed with corn.
So do you put paprika in ahead of time or at the end of the meal?
Smoked paprika at the end. If you're using the other kind, it's saying that basically using it as part of a spice blend, you can put it down at the earliest. But if you really want like the heat of smoked paprika, if it's like an hour long like cook that you're putting like chicken and stuff like in a pot, you don't put it at the very, very end, but maybe like 15 minutes to the end of cook time, so it doesn't completely.
It's kind of funny because I didn't know that, but the recipe app I use is called Paprika, so I should. But I am with you. I know, Jason, you have a recipe app you love, but it's Apple only. And I'm with
Mella.
Yeah, which I love. It's beautiful. But I am like Andy. I'm completely cross-platform, so I need something I can do it on iOS and Android. Very nice. Yep.
And by the way, it also exports really nicely, too. So
yes, I want you to share your sous vide burrito recipe with me, will you?
Oh, that's my restaurant. People come from miles around. I'm known as Sous Vide Burrito Bay on TikTok.
As long as you don't let it run down your forearm, I think that's okay. We were having dinner the other day, and Lisa says, "Where's your dinner?" I said, "Well, I'll have it in an hour and a half. I'm sous viding a burrito." She thought I was a little crazy, but I did follow your technique of frying it up in the pan at the end to get crisp up the tortilla.
So again, everyone's laughing, but the first time you try it, you realize that the stupid microwave burrito that I stopped eating in college because they're awful and they're impossible to cook.
Much
this
better.
Is like now now it's like, oh, this is not as good as a restaurant, but as good as not having to go out of your house to pick up a takeout order at a restaurant.
Of course, if you lived in Petaluma and you had Elroy's taco truck, you might not use a sous vide burrito. It's faster.
I'm on coastal New England. We are really well known for burritos.
No, I can't get lobster rolls and clam cakes here. So it's it's a trade. I'm not sure which I prefer, to be honest.
One must suffer for our geography. Is that not true?
No Dell's frozen lemonade for me. Mr. Jason Snell, pick of the week.
Yeah, I was talking before the show a couple weeks ago with Alex about this. I recently did a get-together of a bunch of the Incomparable podcasters, and we did a bunch of podcasts. Big surprise, podcasts.
Micah was there, and he said he had a great time.
We had a great time. A whole bunch of people who never see each other in person because we're all just on, far away on Zoom. And so my thought was, I want to capture some video of this. And so I got a 360 video camera. Not going to mention its name. But I'll just say that it was an instant
hit. Yes.
360.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What I found out is that you couldn't set that up to catch. The idea is it's too. Okay. My pick is a GoPro Max, which is what I bought and I returned the other one. And
really? Because I have the other one and you prefer this.
So,
huh?
So I prefer this one, and this is why. Other people with different priorities might have a different opinion of it, but it's 280-degree lenses on either side of the camera. So you are going to get a full 360 video out of it. And so I put it on a little tripod in, you know, basically on the floor or on the table. And while we recorded a podcast sort of just around the table, and after the fact, you export out a 360 video file, pop it into Final Cut Pro. It has all of the controls to pan and zoom and tilt around that 360 degree space. And you can actually like say presets and basically make it look like you brought multiple cameras to that thing when there was in fact a little teeny tiny portable camera sitting in the center. Now, the reason I ended up with a GoPro is that the other model stopped recording video after 30 minutes and then started again 10 seconds later.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, before the show the other week, we talked about that. GoPro, every 8 minutes or so, it makes a new file on the SD card, but there's no drop frames. It just keeps going. And if you pull the, if you just plug it into USB power, it will go, because the battery otherwise will die after a while, but it will go until the SD card is full if you have it plugged into power. And I can't be happier with the output. Like the fact that I'm getting, because I'm never in my hobbyist podcasting, especially, going to set up a full on like a bunch of different cameras and maybe with camera operators. And like that's never going to happen. But this 360 grabs everything. And then you can not only lock off those shots that you want, but you can do stuff like you can set a couple of transition points and do a pan and a zoom and a tilt and make it look like somebody's operating that camera, but it's all happening after the effect because it has captured everything. The people around the table, the stuff that's on the table, the ceiling. If you want to show that if there's like a bug on the ceiling, you want to cut to that. It's up there. You can see it. The technology is amazing. It really is like taking smartphone tech and smartphone camera tech and boiling it down to this. And yeah, this is also a GoPro. It has lots of other uses as an action camera and as a waterproof camera and all of that. But there are probably better choices. This is a little bit long in the tooth, but as a 360 camera to capture an event, and maybe, who knows, we'll have headsets and stuff where that 360 video will also come
someday.
But just to produce on the fly some relatively decent video of different angles of people around a table, you plop this in the center, maybe on a tripod, and then you export it right out of the awful software. All the universal thing of all these apps is they come with little, or all these cameras is they come with bad apps, bad Mac apps, bad Windows apps. But you know, you export the file and then you drop it in your video editor of choice and Final Cut.
So you edited it in Final Cut.
I used Final Cut for it. I saved presets for each of the different camera angles. I'm going to write about this on Six Colors because there's a bunch of things I discovered about like stupid things Final Cut doesn't let you do, like save presets and then bind them to a keystroke. It's like, right. I don't know how to do that. But I did do that. And what it affords me is, first off, it's a lot smaller file to have one file that's a 360 file. It's big, but right. It's not three or four, five or six. You can kind of have an arbitrary number of camera angles. And then you can also do animations where you can actually pan and zoom. And there's a moment where people are being introduced around the table. And in my Final Cut project, literally the camera just keeps rotating around as they're introduced.
Nice.
It's so great.
Yeah.
So, and it's all just in that single file.
Can we watch this final show? Where is that?
That's a good point. I should get you the link for that.
Do I have to be a subscriber? I probably do to the Incomparable.
No, you don't. There's actually, I will put the,
cause I'd like to see the
YouTube
result.
I'll put the YouTube link of the first one of these up for people to check out in our Discord, and you can put it in the show notes.
Cool.
But the first one we did was in a poorly lit basement that looked like somebody had been using it as their murder dungeon.
That's okay. You're doing D&D. I think it's appropriate.
It's pretty close, right? Like it's not that far off. But you know, they ended up looking pretty great. So
nice.
That's the part that amazes me is that I was very happy with how it all turned out.
I'm surprised that Final Cut understood the output file.
So what worried me was that when I bought the Insta 360 there, I said it. When I bought that, it said, well, we've got a Premiere plugin. And I thought, nothing for Final Cut. And I thought, oh, geez. It turns out, Final Cut just reads the 360 file. It knows it's a 360 video file.
Nice.
automatically gives you the set of controls that are uniquely for the 360 file.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
In the end, it actually worked out. It worked out great. So I know it's a really niche kind of thing, but like if you've ever been like, I want to capture this group of people just hanging out together. I want to capture, you know, anything that like is not something that you can capture with a single camera. This is a way that you can do it.
The GoPro Max, which I wonder if they have a new one coming.
It's a bit old, although I don't know. I mean, yeah.
I don't think they're going to go down that path. I don't think it was a real success for GoPro, but it is really cool. I mean, it's the best camera in that little area. It's been mostly the post.
In that niche.
How long did it take to render it?
Exporting from the GoPro is a lot faster than exporting from Insta360, and I don't know why.
Oh, interesting.
But the beauty of it is the first set I did, I was rendering the individual shots, and that took forever. But rendering, just exporting out the 360, yeah, it stitches it all together. That didn't take too long.
I was trying to, when I have one, but I barely use it. I used to open it up, and I tried to do it inside of their app because it does stabilization and it does all these other things. And I was like, oh, and it was so painful.
Their app is like, Quick, Quick. They acquired Quick, right?
I don't remember what the app was. It was many years ago now. I was just like, I don't want to play anymore.
Well, there is an advantage to using the app that comes with the camera because they understand better than Final Cut or Premiere what exactly is going on.
But what I didn't do is what Jason's doing, which is really interesting, the raw version. Because when I did it, there was not the tools and Final Cut were very crude. I think it was probably 2017, when it came out. It was new in 2017, I think.
So if whatever happened, Final Cut was like, no, we get 360 video as a thing and we want to support it. And so you can set up a project and this is an enormous video file, right? Like it's like a 5.something K video file, which is good because you have to chop it up into little bits in order to get your shots, but it still ends up being pretty decent. And if my stuff was actually well lit, it would have looked great. It was not well lit. We were just in an Airbnb at a table, but it's still pretty decent. So I was amazed by it. So I think that there are places where people will have that moment of like, oh, for $500, and you can usually find it a little cheaper than that. Totally worth doing.
And in the center of those, a big Chinese ball with a bunch of really bright
lights,
CFLs or LEDs. We'll just give everybody this nice warm light.
I like the way you think.
Yeah,
this is kind of cool. I mean, this is one little camera in the middle of all you guys, and you're just picking who's on camera. And where's the pan? At the beginning or
pan? There's no pan in that one because that's the one where I had the individual shot sectioned up before Mike is in there. But in the new ones that I did, I learned my lesson from that first one, and I've built in the pans, and it's eerie. Like it literally looks like there's a camera operator there, but it's just me setting. Yeah. You know, setting animation points in Final Cut after the fact.
And you've got 8 people, so, and you were able to really get some shots here. That's really good. And of course, the washer and the dryer, which is nice.
And the rest of the murder basement, it's all there.
The Airbnb murder basement, let's not forget.
I don't think they wanted us down there, but all of a sudden we set up a podcast there. So that's never rent your house to podcasters. Stuff like this is going to happen. You're going to regret it.
All of a sudden we set up a podcast.
Circus people are fine, but podcasters never.
This is cool. Boy, I wish I had bought the Insta, and I'm happy with the Insta. But that you nailed the one thing. We were talking about this. How do you record continuously if it's more than half an hour? Yeah. Mr. Alex Lindsay, I think you can wrap things up with your pick of the week.
Yeah, I went to a movie, 32 Sounds. It is a very small art house movie. And if it's going through your town, you should go.
Oh,
like you should go.
I'm just, like the name.
A friend of mine, Tlaloc, was like, you have to go see this movie. And so I was like, okay. And I didn't know anything about the movie. Like it just, Tlaloc told me to go see it and I will go see it. So I showed up, I went with a friend and we went and checked it out. You get there and they give you headsets. So the whole thing is in binaural. So that they give you headsets, little FM headsets. and you're exploring 32 different sounds. And,
John, we
and
have to go see
how
this.
Sound.
This sounds like something sound, John would want to do.
Unfortunately for you, is he just did six over the weekend, and that now he's on a tour. So the great thing is Sam Green, who's the director, he comes with the movie. So he's going to all these locations, and at the end, there's a Q&A with him. And so he talks a little bit about it and answers questions. So
coming to Westerly, Rhode Island, August 29th. I can go see there Andy, go see Mom,
yep.
go see the movie.
There's your reason to go. I would highly recommend it. It is, it's not a action packed film. It's just like you kind of, and at the beginning, I think I was a little restless for the first 30 minutes. And then I found myself just sinking into the experience of just of experiencing sound. They showed there's a woman who has been spending the last 50 years. She's been recording sound underwater. They have a audio artist who is deaf. So she's actually talking about how the sound makes her feel. There are, there's lots of different how binaural works versus ambisonic. There's all these, it's not really technical as much as experiential. And I just really enjoyed it. And I'm really glad that movies like this get made, so I'm hoping that people go out and see it so we get more movies like that. But it was a really just an exploration of sound. It got me thinking about binaural a lot more. I deal with a lot of surround. So I mostly think about ambisonic and Atmos and 5.1 and all these other things. And, I've kind of skipped binaural because it's just with headphones. But when you put the headphones on, it was kind of fun. So hopefully it'll come out, it'll get distribution somehow and we get to put headphones on and watch it at home. But it's a pretty,
That would be
pretty,
cool.
Pretty great
yeah,
movie.
Well, I'll keep an eye out for that. Yeah. Because I don't know if I'm going to make it to Westerly in a month.
You should.
Here's the pan. Jason uploaded a little clip of the pan. So you're doing this. The camera's recording everything. You're doing this in the software, panning
yeah,
from
you
person
just
to
set,
person.
Set little tween points, right? Yeah. You set little keyframes and
yeah.
you can and you can go around and yeah. So this video pans literally all the way around the table, and then in the end, sort of drops down and shows the map and shows everybody's like soda and dice because it's a D&D game. So you gotta for verity's sake, you gotta do that. But it's a fun idea. I literally, somebody said to me the other week when I was talking about this, they said, it's kind of like that 70s show, right? Where there were all those scenes where on that 70s show where they're sitting there talking to each other. And the joke is that the one you don't see is the one who's smoking pot at that moment, but it keeps turning around. And they said, so it's kind of like that. And I said, that is literally my inspiration for this idea
hysterical.
Was what if you could put a camera in the center and then cover all of the different angles around a table. Wouldn't that make, like with Micah and Dan, wouldn't that make a great episode of Clockwise? The whole premise of it is that you're sitting around a table. They're never actually around a table, but what if they were?
Right.
So, yeah, it's worth checking out if you're that person.
Very, very, very cool. It's kind of amazing. You just had one camera there and got all of this.
Yeah, you can see our dice and our sodas. It's like true verisimilitude of D&D.
It looks like a quiet drone just hovering and pivoting.
Right. Cool. Well, that concludes this edition of the We Had Absolutely Nothing to Talk About Mac Break Weekly, 3 hours later. Good Lord. Thank you, Jason Snell. SixColors.com is his website. SixColors.com/Jason is the page where you can see all of the many, many things Jason does,
so many
podcasts and so forth. Where is that D&D show going to be?
That one's not going to be up for a little while, but the game show that we did in the Murder Basement is coming out next week to tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow, actually. So that'll be up. The audio and video version will be up for everybody to see.
On the Incomparable.
On the Incomparable.
Yep.
Incomparable game show. But you can just go to theincomparable.com and you can see it there.
Nice. Very nice. Many, many wonderful things Jason does in August.
I keep my terrible things a secret.
as we all do.
Let's think.
Andy Anacco, WGBH, when are you on next?
I'm off this week, but next Thursday at 12:45, go to WGBHnews.org to stream it live or later or any of the previous stuff I've done on that show.
Very, very nice. Thank you, Andrew. And, of course, Alex Lindsay is at officehours.global all the time. You had a raster versus vector cage match today.
We're talking about how what raster is versus vector. So it was very geeky, just really digging in. We got into the history of it. It was a lot of fun.
I love that.
We had a great presentation on using, kind of a hybrid theater on Monday. which was really cool. And so it was, and, you know, of course it's just a geek fest one day at a time. So, we had by the way, on the Gray Matter show with Michael Krasny, we had Brian Lowry on talking about the nature of community and how we look at that. It's graymatter.show, and it's worth listening to. I mean, all of them are worth listening to. We had David Rubenstein on last week, or it just came out today. But Brian Lowry's was really, really an interesting one that I think this audience might really enjoy, talking about the future of communities and how we interact. So it's really cool.
Very interesting stuff. He knows everybody, which is so fun. So you get everybody on the show.
His
Rolodex is pretty impressive.
Yeah. When David Rubenstein, who's a billionaire, his folks reach out and say we'd like to be on the show, you're nice. Like, hey, we're getting there.
That's nice.
Yeah, so
Gray Matter Show at graymatter.show with Michael Krasny, and Alex produces that in the basement, in his murder basement. It's actually not yours, but it's where you work. Yeah. Thank you, everybody. OfficeHours.global. And of course, if you want to hire Alex, 090.media, 090.media. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800. No, I'm sorry. Is it 1800 or 1900? 1800 UTC. You can watch the stream live.twit.tv. That's got audio or video. After the fact, of course. You can watch the show or listen to the show. There's various places to get it. Our webpage would be the first place you might want to go, twit.tv/MBW. You'll see links there to our YouTube channel, also to many podcast players and the pure RSS feed you can use in any podcast player, or just search for Mac Break Weekly in your podcast player and subscribe. Costs you nothing, and you'll get it the minute it's available. Thursday, Apple's quarterly earning results. We didn't really talk about that, but we will, I'm sure, be talking a lot about that next week on Mac Break Weekly. Going to be a good or bad quarter, Jason?
Bad. I mean, for Apple, which is better than almost anything for anyone else, but it'll be down year over year. I think everybody's predicting that. A little bit down.
Yeah. It is, after all, not a big selling quarter. It's next quarter and the quarter after that really make Apple fly. Thank you, everybody. We'll see y'all next week. But now I have to say, I'm sad to say, my duty is have another Slim Jim, but you got to go back to work because break time is over.
Bye-bye. Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.